Good morning, board members and members of the public. Welcome to the regular meeting of the Lahontan Regional Water Quality Control Board. My name is Amy Horn. I live in Truckee and I am the board chair. Today's board meeting is being conducted both in person and by Zoom. AGP Video is hosting our board meeting. If you are in the Zoom platform, please mute your microphone until you are called to speak. At this time, I would like to introduce the other members of the regional board. At the end, we have Rob Pierce from Chalfont. Next to me is our vice chair, Ezra Mostafabi.
Good morning.
On my other side is Kimberly Cox from Allendale. And at the far end is our newest board member. We will wish him a warm welcome, Rick Deaver from Crestline. This is the date, time, and place set for the hearing in the matter of administrative civil liability complaint number R6T 2023-0027, issued to David Park and Park Livestock Company to assess a penalty of $3,053,026.42. The complaint alleges that David Park and Park Livestock Company violated the Clean Water Act Section 301 and Water Code Section 13376 for a period of 2 days, March 18 through March 19, 2019, by discharging fill material to the West Walker River, a water of the United States, without a permit or Clean Water Act Section 401 water quality certification. The board is being advised today by Jan Zimmerman, raise your hand, supervising engineering geologist, Alonzo Poach, who is, you just heard his voice, he's on the Zoom platform today, senior engineering geologist, Anna Garcia, raise your hand, senior engineering geologist specialist, and Tiffany Steinhardt, engineering geologist. The board is also being advised by Elizabeth Barrett and Lori Oaken, who are attorneys with the Office of Chief Counsel. Members of the prosecution team include Ben Letton, Assistant Executive Officer, Liz Van Diepen, Engineering Geologist, German Myers, Water Resource Control Engineer, and Shelby Parker. Shelby in the room, or is she on Zoom? Okay. Senior Engineering Geologist Specialist, Naomi Rubin and Carson Capps, attorneys with the State Water Board Office of Enforcement, are representing the prosecution team. Neither they nor the prosecution team staff have ever been or are now advising the Lahontan Water Board in this matter. David Park and Park Livestock Company, referred to here as respondents, are represented by Valerie Kincaid. Raise your hand, please. Thank you. And Jonathan Mars. Thank you. All board members and party representatives are physically present in the meeting room. Two witnesses, Chad Elliott and Nick Buckmaster of the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, will address the board meeting using the Zoom platform. Their counsel, Stephanie Mello, will also be on Zoom. One member of the advisory team, Alonzo Poach, is also on the Zoom platform. The official record of the testimony at this hearing will be created by our court reporter. The hearing will also be recorded, but the recording will not be the official record of this meeting. At the end of this hearing, the Lahontan Water Board will close the hearing in this matter, and the board will deliberate. The deliberations may be in closed session. After deliberating, the Lahontan Board will determine whether to affirm, reject, or modify the administrative civil liability proposed in the complaint. The board may announce its decision and adopt an order today, or continue this matter and adopt an order at a future board meeting. The board has required the submission of evidence in accordance with the hearing procedures, and new written evidence should not be submitted during this hearing other than rebuttal evidence pertaining to an issue raised solely during oral testimony. or as otherwise stated by the chair. Under our regulations, the board has the authority to exclude evidence where submission requirements have not been met and will refuse the acceptance of any such evidence where there is a finding of prejudice to any party of the board or the board. This rule may be modified upon a showing of severe hardship. If you use any visual aids illustrating previously submitted evidence with your presentation, those will be made a part of the record. No other documentary evidence will be accepted into the record unless the board makes a specific ruling to allow it. So I understand we did not receive any written comments from non-parties. Is that correct?
Did anybody fill out a speaker card that was in the back of the room? Can you bring those to the clerk, Katrina Fleshman? She has her hand raised.
Okay, I stand corrected. We have received 3 speaker cards. Is that correct? 4?
And my apologies to your original question about whether we received any written comments from non-parties. We did not.
Thank you. Okay. 6. Okay, we have received 6 speaker cards for this item. The hearing will be conducted in accordance with the 3rd revised final hearing procedure and the order of proceedings. We will proceed as follows. First, the prosecution team will present evidence. Then respondents will cross-examine prosecution team's witnesses, followed by the respondents' presentation of their evidence. Fourth, the prosecution team will cross-examine respondents' witnesses. Fifth, the prosecution team will have the opportunity to rebut. Sixth, there's opportunity for respondents to cross-examine or provide additional rebuttal testimony. And that's when public interested party comments can be heard after that, with a 3-minute time limit for each commenter. That will be followed by the closing statement from the prosecution team. And finally, the respondent's closing statement. Any party wishing to present an opening statement should do so at the beginning of their evidentiary presentation. Any party wishing to conduct redirect or recross examination should request permission to do so at the appropriate time. The prosecution team and the respondents each have 60 minutes for the opening and closing statements, presentations or direct examination of witnesses, cross-examination and closing statements. A question for the attorneys. How does time used for objections count? Is that part of the 60 minutes or not?
I'm sorry? Yeah, we may stop the clock at that time.
Okay, and for redirect and that kind of stuff?
That will go to the party conducting that portion of the examination.
Okay, thank you. The board members and the advisory team may ask questions of the parties and witnesses at any time. The time spent answering questions will not be deducted from this party's 60-minute time allotments. So questions from the board will stop the clock, right? Yeah, just to be clear. Okay, as this opening statement makes clear, this will be a long day. I and other board members may stand periodically to stretch. If anyone else needs to stand, please feel free to do so and stand on the sides or the back of the room in a way that would not be disruptive to the proceedings. I will now administer the oath. If you intend to provide testimony on this matter, please stand and raise your right hand. If you are on the Zoom platform, please turn on your camera and raise your right hand as well. Alonzo, I assume you are doing that. Do you solemnly state under penalty of perjury that the evidence that you shall give in this matter shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Do.
Thank you very much. If you are presenting testimony, you must state your name and whether you have taken the oath before testifying. Before we begin, are there any other outstanding procedural matters that need to be addressed by either party's counsel? Hearing none.
I believe you said this, Valerie Kincaid for Park yes. Livestock. I believe you said this, but there's a 60-minute period for all portions besides questions and objections for either side. I just want to confirm that that's everyone's understanding.
That is everyone's understanding. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. And Alonzo Poach will have a timer on his side. So if you ever need to ask how much time is left, you can do so.
Terrific. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Okay. Council for the Lahontan Water Board, are there any matters that you would like to address before we begin?
No, I think we're ready to go. My understanding is that the presentation materials that we provided, that are they loaded somewhere where we will be able to pull them up with? Okay, then yeah, no procedural matters.
And Council for the Lahontan Water Board doesn't have any matters to discuss either.
All right, thank you. Okay, with that, we will proceed with the presentation from the prosecution team.
Hello, Chair Horn and board members. My name is Naomi Rubin. I am lead counsel for the Lahontan Water Board prosecution team, which includes Ben Letton, Elizabeth Van Diepen, German Myers, in addition to other members and co-counsel. Why are we here today? This video was taken by a California Department of Fish and Wildlife warden on March 19, 2019. We are here because this video shows the precise type of discharge the Clean Water Act, the Porter-Cologne Water Quality Act, and the 401 permitting program are designed to prevent, and the type of discharge for which the Water Code allows us to impose up to $10,000 per day of violation and $10 per gallon discharge. The prosecution team has calculated that over 381,000 gallons of fill material was deposited over a two-day period in March of 2019. The evidence shows that the cause of the violation was not an accident. It was the intention of David Park and his company, Park Livestock Co., collectively the dischargers, to straighten the river, literally straighten the river without a permit. This matter is unique in the severity of the violations. In addition, the complete disregard of legal requirements and refusal to acknowledge any wrongdoing is something we do not generally encounter. After this opening statement, you will hear Ms. Van Diepen and Mr. Myers discuss how we got to this point. They will describe the evidence we gathered, how we utilized the enforcement policy to reach the proposed liability amount of $3,053,026. You will hear why the proposed liability is necessary, not only to prevent a general deterrent to the regulated public, but also to specifically deter these dischargers from continuing to straighten rivers in the Antelope Valley hydrologic area. Let us consider the prosecution team's burden of proof, which is preponderance of the evidence. This means simply more likely than not. The enforcement policy methodology is a refinement of the factors you are required to consider under Water Code Section 13385E. The proposed liability, which is based on that policy's application, is conservative, warranted, and harmonious with years of adjudicated decisions that guide us. So in listening to what is brought before you today, you should consider the amount of evidence, the persuasiveness of that evidence, and a party's self-interest in obscuring or distorting certain items of evidence. And you make the determination of what is more likely than not. I want to remind you of something else as you consider this case. The prosecution team is basing its conclusions on expectations set forth in the regulatory framework in which we operate. The Clean Water Act prohibits unauthorized discharges of dredge and fill material to waters of the U.S. without a permit. The prosecution team's volume estimate is consistent with that and considers the amount of fill material discharged to the West Walker River within the ordinary high water mark. Rather than challenge the prosecution team's estimate by providing their own, which they were ordered to do by directive, the dischargers have taken the position that the West Walker River is not a jurisdictional water body and that the discharge had no potential for harm, which are both positions totally inconsistent with the evidence and legal framework. This slide depicts the difference in the parties' expectations. The dischargers do not dispute that they straightened the river without a permit. Instead of disputing those facts, you will hear them make all kinds of arguments that fall under the second bullet point on the right, after the fact legal arguments made in an attempt to avoid liability. So why did this matter take so long to get before the board? Regional board staff issued an investigative directive to the dischargers early on, which ordered them to provide information about the dredge and fill activities, including an estimate of the volume discharged. When this particular directive was not complied with, the prosecution team had to undertake its own lengthy investigation to estimate that volume. In addition, the prosecution team issued a number of investigative subpoenas in order to determine who to name in the complaint and to discover other facts about the violation. Let me walk you through a typical case. The foundation is the regulatory framework. It's the water code, the enforcement policy, required permits, all which represent decades of decisions by lawmakers, regulatory agencies, and the courts put in place to protect public resources. In this case, those decisions were completely disregarded by the dischargers. The second level are the facts of a particular case. Here we have an abundance of evidence. We have over 150 photographs, 9 videos, inspection reports from multiple state agencies. We have admissions that the dischargers themselves made in response to our investigative directives and subpoenas, and we have staff testimony that you'll hear today. The pointed narrow roof is the legal arguments you will hear. Lawyers have a saying that when you have bad law, argue the facts, and when you have bad facts, argue the law. The facts here are bad for the dischargers. They flagrantly disregarded federal and state law and took it upon themselves to straighten a river. In 99% of our cases, the facts are known prior to hearing. This is in part because the prosecution team goes to great lengths to investigate violations to ensure that it's getting the right message to the right party. The prosecution team undertook a thorough and rigorous investigation in this case, submitted its evidence, and what followed were a myriad of legal challenges and objections to the enforcement process. This slide shows Ms. Van Diepen in a hat, bearing the water board's name and logo, inspecting the site of violation on March 25th, 2019, and talking closely with Mr. Park. One of the legal arguments you will hear the dischargers make is that the regional board's evidence in this matter was obtained unlawfully. However, the evidence shows that Mr. Park consented to the regional board's inspection, and even if he had not done so, the regional board's evidence would not be barred as it was obtained in open fields. The regional board inspection report, which was written close to the event when memories were still fresh, states that Mr. Park gave consent to regional board staff. Ms. Van Diepen, who attended the inspection, has declared that she always introduces herself as regional board staff when conducting site inspections. That consent was obtained from Mr. Park is further corroborated by California Department of Fish and Wildlife Citation Investigation Report and Memorandum, and by testimony you will hear today. Despite this evidence, the dischargers will argue that consent was not obtained based on a mere statement made by Mr. Park in March of this year, stating that he doesn't exactly recall what was said at the inspection. Even if we were to ignore all of the evidence that shows Mr. Park gave consent to regional board staff, reliance on the prosecution team's evidence is permissible because of the open fields doctrine. As established in Hester v. U.S. and expanded upon in Oliver v. U.S., the special protection afforded under the Fourth Amendment to the people in their persons, houses, papers, and effects does not extend to open fields. Because open fields are accessible to the public and government in ways that a home, office, or commercial structure are not, and because fences or no trespassing signs do not effectively bar the public from viewing open fields, the expectation of privacy in open fields is not one that society recognizes as reasonable. This is even more so in this case, where the inspection took place not just in an open field, far away from any house or office, but directly in and adjacent to a river running through that open field. That river is public property, for which there is absolutely no expectation of privacy. Thus, even if the regional board had committed a trespass, which the prosecution team avers did not happen, the general rights of property protected by the common law of trespass have little or no relevance to the applicability of the Fourth Amendment. You will hear respondents argue today that the regional board does not have jurisdiction to protect the West Walker River. Respondents rely primarily on a case that predates the Federal Clean Water Act by over 30 years. But as we address in our rebuttal brief and here today, the West Walker River is precisely the type of water body intended to be protected under the Act and falls squarely within its scope of protection under any iteration of the federal water rule. As you will hear from staff testimony, the West Walker River is a tributary to Walker Lake and is itself a traditionally navigable water. Evidence in the record supports the conclusion that West Walker River is a waters of the United States. Included as prosecution team rebuttal exhibit one is a prior order of this board, which includes as an attachment a wetland delineation that finds West Walker River to be a traditionally navigable water. You will see in this presentation a United States Geological Survey map included as prosecution team rebuttal exhibit 46, showing that West Walker River is tributary to Walker Lake. And included as prosecution team rebuttal exhibit 49 is a traditional navigable water delineation from the United States Army Corps of Engineers, finding that Walker Lake is a traditionally navigable water. You will also hear respondents claim that the prosecution team has failed to show that the violation resulted in any harm or even had a potential for harm. They will make this argument with a straight face, despite ample photographs and videos depicting bulldozers driving through the flowing river, depicting areas of the original river footprint that have been completely submerged in dirt and are no longer able to support aquatic life, and depicting gallons upon gallons upon gallons of discharged earthen materials. You will hear opposing counsel argue that the prosecution team member Mr. Myers is not qualified to analyze the volume of the material discharged and that the assumptions and inputs in his model are untrustworthy. However, you will see that his assumptions, which were made with the assistance of regional board staff who witnessed the scene of the discharge, are reasonable estimations based on evidence. And furthermore, you will see that in developing the volume analysis, a number of conservative decisions were made that result in a volume that likely underestimates the full extent of discharge. We are operating largely in separate realities. As you see on the slide here are but a few of the disputed issues. Where the prosecution team identifies a significant potential for harm, the dischargers see none. Where the prosecution team, after months of analysis, conclude that over 381,000 gallons were discharged, the dischargers conclude none were. Where the prosecution team view Mr. Park and his company as at least somewhat culpable in failing to obtain a permit, the dischargers argue that it was more than reasonable for Mr. Park to believe that all environmental laws and regulations were suspended following the governor's emergency proclamation. And where the prosecution team concludes that Mr. Park and his company could have been more cooperative by submitting plans requested in the notice of violation, the dischargers see no fault at all. As stated previously, we cannot even agree on whether the West Walker River is a river subject to the protections afforded under state and federal law. Adversarial hearings like this are not the default. Most matters settle. Despite efforts here, this matter did not proceed in a way that would allow the prosecution team to stand before this board and support an agreed upon penalty. We are confident that after you hear both parties' cases in their entirety, you will see that the prosecution team's case is comprised of evidence, including contemporaneous inspection reports, photographs, and videos. The discharger's case, by contrast, is based almost entirely on legal challenges to the prosecution team's evidence, witnesses, and the water board process. We believe that you will see right through their attempts to sow confusion into this process, and will find that given our burden of proof, the facts more than support the proposed penalty. That concludes my opening statement, but prior to the prosecution team's narrative presentation, I would like to take the opportunity to address some evidentiary issues by having witnesses come up and affirm their declarations as well as other matters. Ms. O'Keefe, could you please approach the podium? Please state your name and whether you've taken the oath.
Yes, my name is Carrie O'Keefe and I have taken the oath.
Ms. O'Keefe, have you reviewed the photographs contained in Prosecution Team Rebuttal Exhibit 2 and Prosecution Team Exhibit 12?
Yes, I reviewed both exhibits.
Did your review include the metadata for the photos?
Yes, I reviewed the metadata for the photos.
And are there metadata errors?
Yes, there are metadata errors in the photos.
What are those errors?
Date and timestamp.
How many times have you been to the site on which the subject violation took place?
One time.
And when was that?
March of 2019.
Did you take a camera?
Yes, I took a camera.
Did you take pictures at the site with your camera?
Yes, I took pictures at the site.
And what did you do with your photographs on your camera when you returned from the site visit?
I took them off the camera and saved them onto our regional shared drive.
Thank you. Please have a seat. Ms. Van Diepen, could you please approach? Please state your name and whether you've taken the oath.
Elizabeth Van Diepen, I have taken the oath.
Ms. Van Diepen, do you affirm the statements in your declaration, which is marked as Prosecution Team Rebuttal Exhibit 37?
Yes, all the statements in there are correct, except there's a typo on page 3, line 7. It says that I checked all the photos for metadata, and I checked, in reality, I checked all the CDFW photos, so there was a typo.
And why did you review the CDFW photos for metadata errors?
Because CDFW staff were out there two different days.
Did you review all your photo files, which are included as Prosecution Team Rebuttal Exhibit 3?
Yes, I did.
Are there metadata errors in your photographs?
Yes, the camera was set 12 hours ahead of the actual time, and so the AM and PM were switched.
How many times did you visit the site?
Once, on March 25th, 2019.
And what was the approximate time you arrived and left the site?
I arrived at approximately 11 a.m. and left at approximately 1 p.m. that day.
And what did you do with your photos after the site visit?
I saved them to a folder in the project file.
And did you obtain Ms. O'Keefe's photographs after the site visit?
Yes, I did.
What did you do with her photos?
I saved her photos to a separate folder.
Did you author in part the complaint and associated penalty methodology analysis?
Yes.
Would anything in the complaint or methodology have changed based upon one of your or Carrie's photographs being taken at 11 a.m. versus 1 p.m. on the March 25th, 2019 inspection date?
No, nothing changed.
Thank you. Please have a seat. Mr. Letton? Please state your name and whether you've taken the oath.
Ben Letton, I have taken the oath.
Mr. Letton, do you affirm the statements made in your declarations, which are marked as Prosecution Team Exhibit 7 and Prosecution Team Rebuttal Exhibit 36?
Yes, I affirm those statements.
Thank you. Please have a seat. And at this time, I'd like to call Warden Chad Elliott, who is joining by the Zoom platform.
Mr. Elliott, feel free to unmute yourself and do a microphone check.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Good morning.
Warden Elliott, do you mind just stating your name for the record and confirming that you've taken the oath?
Yes. Good morning. My name is Chad Elliott, and I have taken the oath.
And do you affirm the statements made in your declaration, which is marked as Prosecution Team Rebuttal Exhibit 35?
I do.
You had your deposition taken in this matter, correct?
Yes, I have.
In your deposition, you discussed that at the March 25th, 2019 inspection, which included your staff as well as regional board staff, at some point, you drove vehicles to the east side of the river with Mr. Park and regional board staff to access his side of the property. Do you affirm that?
Yes, I do.
At some point, either before getting into those vehicles or upon getting out, were introductions made with David Park?
Yes, as I recall, they were.
And during those introductions, people stated their names and titles?
Correct.
At any point before or after that, did Mr. Park object to Lahontan Regional Board staff being present at that inspection?
Not to me, no.
Thank you. That's all. And with that, I'll turn over the narrative part of the back to the narrative part of the presentation to Ms. Van Diepen. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Liz Van Diepen. I'm an engineering geologist with the Lahontan Regional Board's 401 Water Quality Certification Program, also known as a 401 or Dredge and Fill Program. As Ms. Rubin previously stated, we're here today to propose a liability of approximately $3 million based on almost 2,000 cubic yards of fill material discharged into the West Walker River over a two-day period. 401 certifications are required for dredge and fill discharges in waters of the U.S., and they're imperative to protecting water quality in both the short and long term. In this case, the discharger's activities resulted in excessive sedimentation and habitat loss. The dischargers disregarded critical state and federal regulations when they relocated the channel and demolished approximately 2 acres of aquatic and riparian habitat without a permit. By failing to apply for and obtain a 401 certification, they violated Clean Water Act Section 301 and Porter Cologne Section 13376. For this case, we are alleging one violation. Here is an outline of Mr. Myers in my presentation. First, I'll provide some general background on the West Walker River and discharge site and describe the violation in more detail. After that, I'll walk you through the events that have transpired since we were first notified of the violation, which align with the principles of progressive enforcement. Mr. Myers and I will then discuss the enforcement policy's 10-step penalty methodology that we applied to derive the proposed liability. I'll highlight the importance of this enforcement work and conclude with our recommendation for board action today. The West Walker is a perennial river that drains from its headwaters near Sonora Pass through Walker Canyon and the northern Antelope Valley of our region into Nevada, where it meets with the East Walker to form the Walker River. From there, it drains to its terminus at Walker Lake, a traditionally navigable water and important cultural site for the Northern Paiute. The Northern Paiute were originally called a name that translates from their native tongue to trout eaters, signifying the importance of fish to their way of life. The West Walker is a freestone river with no main stem dams upstream of the discharge site, which is marked with a red star. This lack of upstream flow controls results in a natural hydrologic regime ideal for cold water aquatic species.
Ms. Van Diepen, what is a freestone river?
It's a river with no dams, no main stem dams upstream of it. The West Walker is one of the area's best freestone rivers for anglers and known to host fishing derbies. In addition to aquatic life, this river supports wildlife such as bear, foxes, bobcats, deer, and quail. Via Highways 108 and 395, it's easily accessible and sees significant recreational use. I have personally navigated sections of the West Walker in small watercrafts, and I've seen whitewater kayakers descending Walker Canyon from Highway 395. I can attest to the fact that both the West Walker and Walker River are tributary to Walker Lake. The West Walker is on the Clean Water Act Section 303D list of impaired water bodies for boron, chloride, phosphorus, total dissolved solids, and turbidity. The discharger's lease property for livestock production at the discharge site pictured here, which is just north of the town of Colville in Mono County at an elevation of about 5,000 feet. Mr. Park is a president and majority stakeholder of Park Livestock Co., and he's responsible for managing its day-to-day activities. In March 2019, he directed his employees to bulldoze this section of river without making any attempts to contact our office nor apply for permits. This image from the fall of 2018 depicts conditions at the time of the discharge. The flow of water goes from the lower right side of the photo to the upper left side. It's doing something on its own. Sorry about that. So the flow of water goes from the lower right side of the photo to the upper left side. The discharger straightened the river by cutting off and filling the two meanders shown here using material excavated from stream banks and the newly created channel, which is illustrated with this yellow line. Shortly following Game Warden Elliott's initial site visit in which he halted work, I received a call from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, hereafter referred to as CDFW, reporting unpermitted earthwork in the West Walker. David Park had directed his employees to straighten the river using a bulldozer and two excavators. As Mr. Myers will discuss shortly, that amount is conservative and likely underestimates the true extent of this violation that resulted in the destruction of high-quality habitat. Violations of the Federal Clean Water Act are subject to penalties up to $10,000 per day and $10 per gallon in excess of the first 1,000 gallons discharged and not cleaned up. I'll now show a series of videos that were all taken by CDFW's Warden Elliott, where you'll see the extent of the damage that occurred. Here you can see the downstream grading limits. Undisturbed coarse grain sediments dominated by cobbles are clearly visible as a lighter color in the background because they lack fine sediments, which get flushed out when subjected to flows. Turbid water is evident on the banks of the newly straightened channel and in adjacent ponded areas, indicating what the river may have looked like during equipment operations. All of the dark soil shown here represents portions of the river covered in dirt. This video shows the extent of grading in the downstream portion of the discharge area, as well as portions of the former river channel that's been filled in, which has obliterated aquatic habitat in this reach. You can see the bulldozer and two excavators Park Livestock Co. employees utilized to conduct this work. This is about the midpoint of the disturbed portion of the river where the pre-existing channel intersects with the newly excavated channel. I'd like to highlight that protection measures typically utilized for grading in live streams, such as a clear water diversion to isolate work areas from flowing waters, were not implemented here. This supports our assertion that the discharger's failure to obtain a 401 certification rendered that requirement completely ineffective. This video was taken near the upstream grading limits during our joint inspection several days after Warden Elliott halted work. Shown here are irrigated lands and fences this work was intended to protect. Vertical cuts on the stream bank are evidence of the newly excavated channel. All of this work occurred below the river's ordinary high water mark. I'll now go through the timeline.
Excuse me, the previous videos before this last one were all, what date were those previous videos taken?
So the last video I showed was on March 25th, and all the other ones were March 19th when Warden Elliott halted the work initially. I'll now go through a timeline of this case. As previously noted, I was alerted to this violation in March 2019 and conducted my inspection several days later. Contrary to the discharger's claim, although I don't remember the exact words uttered, I identified myself as a waterboard staff to Mr. Park, as I do at every site visit. We sent an NOV with accompanying inspection report in April 2019, recommending the dischargers develop both a short-term plan to stabilize disturbed soils in preparation for upcoming snowmelt, as well as a long-term plan to restore functionality of the site. A long-term restoration plan was never provided. While short-term stabilization via compaction and armoring was proposed, no such plan was implemented. As the dischargers admitted, high flows in the river following the discharge made it impossible to safely access the site until later that summer. In part due to high spring melt flows, mitigating this damage was impossible. In August 2019, we issued a 13267 investigative order for a technical report characterizing the work, including volume discharged. While we did receive a response, it did not provide the information required. Because of that, we began the long process of analyzing the discharge using information presented here today. Between June 2020 and October 21, we engaged in pre-issuance investigations to build our case, which included issuance of investigative subpoenas. From February 22 to June 23, we conducted confidential settlement negotiations and gave the dischargers ample opportunity to settle this case outside of today's contested hearing. We formally issued the ACL and complaint in July last year, with a board hearing initially set for October. Because the basis for liability starts with the volume discharge to lands below the river's ordinary high water mark, I'll now hand it off to Mr. Myers to describe the analysis he performed. And yeah, the slides are advancing without me touching anything, so I'm not sure what's going on here.
Prosecution team, do you want to pause the timer while we figure
out? Yeah, if we could pause and maybe get a little technical assistance, that would be great.
Timer's paused.
What's going on?
Good morning. My name is German Myers, and I am a water resource control engineer with the State Water Board's Office of Enforcement, and I am part of the prosecution team, and I have taken the oath today. I am the individual that performed the economic benefit analysis and the volume calculation with the assistance of other members of the prosecution team. We determined the economic benefit by assessing permit fees using the State Water Board's dredge and fill calculator and by assessing a bank stabilization alternative project using widely accepted resources to estimate costs. Ms. Van Diepen will talk more about the economic benefit later, but for now, let's discuss the method that we use to estimate the volume of fill material to the West Walker River. Slide. So what did we want to know? We wanted to know the volume of fill material that was discharged into the watercourse. Typically, with these type of cases, we rely on information provided by the discharger to make our assessments. As mentioned earlier, an investigative order was issued to the discharger requiring them to submit a technical report estimating the volume of material discharge. Unfortunately, this report submitted failed to include this estimate and rather estimated the volume of material removed from and deposited to the river between June 2011 and September 2019, an 8-year period. Because of the lack of information and specific site data, we had to rely on other information, which included photographs taken during the inspections by regional board and CDFW staff, aerial imagery, and on-the-ground information provided by those inspectors. Slide. Yes. These photos here give an example of what we had to work with. In the top left photo, we can see fill material in small stockpiles scattered throughout the watercourse. In the top right photo, we can see a large stockpile in the right of the photo and an excavator actively working in the watercourse. The videos shown earlier are even further evidence of the amount of work that was done. In order to estimate the volume, we had to make assumptions regarding the extent of fill material and relative dimensions. We did this by analyzing photo locations and comparing the fill material to objects seen in those photos, objects with assumed heights, such as the height of the cliff bank and fence seen in the top left photo, and the heights of the people seen in the bottom two photos. I will explain this more in depth in the next slides, but this process was also explained in depth during my deposition testimony and the statements in the deposition transcript with the errata sheets submitted as Prosecution Team Rebuttal Exhibit 29 are true and correct. Next slide, please. We started off by mapping the photos taken during the inspections and overlaid them onto aerial imagery using GIS software, as seen in these two photos. We estimated the photo location based on information provided by inspectors, review of the photos, and comparison with geomorphic and anthropogenic features that can be seen in both the aerial imagery and the photos. Features such as trees, dirt roads, fence lines, existing stockpiles, and so forth. The aerial imagery scene was taken in September 2018, which is assumed to be a good representation of site conditions prior to the unauthorized activity. Next slide, please. Once we had the photos mapped out on the aerial imagery, we then estimated the disturbed area by mapping out the areas with the polygons within the GIS software, again, based on review of the photos and information provided. From this, we were able to identify three distinct areas in the upper disturbed area and four distinct areas in the lower disturbed area. I should note that the material excavated and dredged by the discharger, for example, those material removed to create those new channels, were not added to the total volume, as it is assumed that this volume of excavated material was used as fill material in other disturbed areas. Had we included the volume of excavated material, the total estimated volume could have been up to two times higher. Next slide, please. Once the areas were estimated as described in the previous slide, we then assumed an average depth and other needed relative dimensions for each disturbed area, again, based on review of those photos and information provided, and used volumetric formulas to determine the volume for each area. The total estimated volume of fill material that was discharged to the watercourse as a result of this unauthorized activity was estimated to be 1,891 cubic yards, which is equivalent to 381,843 gallons using the displacement method and a ratio of 1:1. If we go back to the discharger's technical report submitted in response to the investigative order, the discharger estimated that 11,300 cubic yards of fill material was deposited to the watercourse over that 8-year period. It's not unreasonable to assume, as an entirely possible, that of that 11,300 cubic yards over the 8-year period, only 1,891 cubic yards of it was caused by the unauthorized activity. Next slide, please. Now I want to go over and reiterate a couple key points regarding the analysis. For one, and as mentioned earlier, the volume of fill material that was calculated is a conservative estimate based on the information that was available. Other methods to determine volume would have required information that was not available. Secondly, flow was at a minimum during the 6-month period prior to the unauthorized event, making the September 2018 aerial imagery an assumed good representation of site conditions. As indicated by USGS data, which is depicted in the top graph here, flow within the West Walker River was approximately 70 cubic feet per second on average between September 2018 and March 2019. Flows drastically increased during the summer months and reached close to 3,000 cubic feet per second, where a high degree of accretion and effusion in the channel is expected. Lastly, I want to go over porosity and why a 1:1 displacement ratio was used. Porosity refers to the void spaces between material particles. Defining porosity gets complicated when there is a mixed particle distributions, since smaller particles will fill the void spaces of larger particles, as shown in the diagram at the bottom of this slide, effectively reducing the overall porosity. While there may be some value for porosity in streambed sediment, another factor to consider is saturation. Fill material that is fully saturated would introduce a volume-for-volume displacement, as the void spaces within the fill material would be occupied by highly turbid water. For this case, the fill material was attained from the streambed itself, where some degree of saturation is likely. Because the soil type, particle size distribution, and degree of saturation are unknown factors, but also knowing that porosity was likely reduced and there was some degree of saturation, a 1:1 volume displacement ratio is reasonable as it includes the volume of turbid water within those void spaces. Next slide, please. In summary, because of the lack of site data, we use GIS and available information such as photos, aerial imagery, and information provided by those inspectors to estimate the volume of fill material discharged to the West Walker River. The total estimated volume of fill material was calculated to be 1,891 cubic yards, or 381,843 gallons, using the displacement method and a ratio of 1:1. In addition to using conservative assumptions in the analysis, this estimate is also conservative since the analysis does not include the volume of water contaminated by the unauthorized activity as water flowed through the area, through the disturbed area, over a period of time. Now I'll hand it back over to Ms. Van Diepen to go over the 10-step methodology.
Can we stop the clock for a minute? Let me ask a question. Should I wait till I hear from Mr. Poach?
Board Chair, the clock has stopped.
Thank you. So in the respondents' material, they talked about going back to the pore size effect, that your estimates had not considered the role that compaction might have played in the volume of the discharge. So looked like that there was a fair amount of heavy equipment running over the material that was placed in the stream bed. What would that have done? How would compaction caused by that equipment have affected pore size?
Right. So compaction would reduce porosity. So as the soil gets compacted, it basically kind of shoves the particles within the, those void spaces. So as those excavators would be going over that soil material, it would be compacted, reducing the porosity as well.
And how would that have affected the volume of your estimates?
Well, for this estimate, we didn't include porosity, so it wouldn't have affected our analysis because we elected to include the pore sizes. But theoretically, with the compaction, it would have changed it if we were doing the volume of just the sediment, but we elected to include the volume within those pore spaces as well.
Okay, thank you. That's it. Do other board members have questions of Mr. Myers before we go on? Dr. Cox.
Yeah, thank you. I've accumulated a list of questions here, but I think specific to this presentation. So the soil that was moved around within the river channel was the river channel soil itself, right? No other soil was brought in non-native to that.
That's correct. Our understanding is the soil was from the stream bed itself.
And do we have any aerial photos over time of this site?
There is aerial photos, but from my understanding, when we reviewed, the aerial photos occurred after the summer months where high flows occurred, and was not a good representation of kind of what the site looked like.
Okay, so we don't have like time photos, because in my region we have photos done every year so we can watch the changes in the river course.
We can. There is updated photos from the photo we use. We use a September 2018 because we believe that to be a good representation of site conditions. The next photo I believe we were able to find would be August 2019, but that was after high flows occurred and it was no longer apparent kind of what the disturbed area was due to those high flows.
Okay, so we don't have like 10 years of photos before the event and then.
There is previous photos as well. I believe in the respondents' technical report, they included aerial imagery. I think that stemmed all the way back from 2006. I think there's 2016 data. So that there is photos out there that have historic aerial imagery.
Okay, thank you. That's all.
Other board members have any questions for Mr. Myers?
Okay. Perhaps one follow-up. When you say it changed the volume or changed the compaction of the soil, can you elaborate on that as to whether it increases it or decreases it for the record? Thank you.
So if the soil was compacted overall, it would, if you were just looking at the volume of the sediment without the pore values, it would basically be the same because it's just the volume of the sediment. The total volume, including the pore sizes, would decrease though. But for this analysis, we included the pore values, the pore volume, because it would contain that turbid water.
Thank you.
Okay, I think we're ready to go back on the clock.
Excuse me, Board Chair. The advisory team has one follow-up question for Mr. Marks.
Okay.
Could you explain why 6 inches was chosen for calculating the volume?
Sure. So based on a review of the photographs, looking at the disturbed areas, we determined that the range of fill material, it varied throughout the entire site. So some places it could have been 3 inches, some places it reached 4 feet with larger stockpiles. So we used just an average depth of 6 inches, which is on the lower side of the spectrum. Because if with 4 feet of fill material, that's 48 inches, but we elected to use 6 inches as an average throughout the whole disturbed area.
Thank you. Excuse me, Board Chair, does the respondents want to cross-examine Mr. Myers now or at the end of all the witnesses?
I think we'll make that decision after the prosecution team is done.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we're ready to resume the prosecution team testimony.
Next slide, please. Okay, thanks. I'll now cover the State Water Board's 2017 water quality enforcement policy and how we used it for this case. This policy established the 10-step methodology shown here for assessing administrative civil liability. Overarching policy goals are to be fair, firm, consistent, and transparent in taking enforcement actions throughout the state. A maximum of $10 per gallon and $10,000 per day can be assessed for Clean Water Act violations. From that baseline, a number of adjustment factors were applied that takes case-specific information into account. I'd like to note that we realize this calculation is complicated, but details surrounding these factors are critical to the final liability proposed. In the interest of time, I've made an attempt to limit specifics, and I'm happy to describe how these factors were derived in more depth following the presentation. That's the right one. Thanks. Step one considers the harm the violation caused or may have caused, which is the sum of the three factors listed here. Next. This photo taken by Warden Elliott depicts site conditions on the day he halted work. Factor one of step one is the degree of toxicity of the material discharged on a scale of 0 to 4. This factor takes physical, chemical, biological, and/or thermal characteristics of the material into account, which is in this case is sediment. Sediment discharges cloud water, reducing light transmission and increasing water temperature, which reduces dissolved oxygen available for aquatic organisms. Sediment discharges can also abrade and clog fish gills, smother aquatic habitat and spawning areas, and bury macroinvertebrates. Sediment can also transport materials such as nutrients, metals, and oils and grease, which can negatively impact aquatic life, promote algal growth, and expose human and wildlife receptors to adsorb toxicants. Due to these characteristics, sediment discharged poses a moderate risk or threat to potential receptors, which corresponds to a score of 2. The next factor, actual harm or potential harm to beneficial uses, is assigned a score between 0 and 5. Beneficial uses for the West Walker in our basin plan are listed here. While all listed beneficial uses were likely affected as a result of the discharger's actions, we expect the most significant and longest lasting impacts were related to fish and wildlife. The dischargers have argued that beneficial uses were not affected because Water Board and CDFW staff testified that we did not directly observe wildlife or recreational activities during site inspections. Regardless, existing beneficial uses don't need to be presently occurring in order to be protected. The dischargers denuded approximately 2 acres of aquatic and riparian habitat and increased sedimentation downstream of the modified river, eliminating any existing spawning habitat for fish within and potentially downstream of the filled river channel, and destroying habitat for macroinvertebrates that are a vital food source for other animals. High turbidity levels can also result in harm to fish by reducing feeding and resistance to disease, lowering growth rates, and affecting egg and larval development. Sport fishing was also adversely affected through potential fish mortality, destruction of spawning habitat in the affected reach, and a reduction in the visibility of lures and bait due to increased turbidity levels.
These impacts could last set for several days, such as those related to sediment-laden water, or for months or longer until river flows were able to redistribute the discharge sediment downstream and channel conditions were restored to pre-grading conditions. In the case of mature riparian trees that were removed, impacts to wildlife and cold freshwater habitat from the loss of nesting sites and shading could last years or longer. Based on this information, the discharge resulted in major harm to beneficial uses, which warrants the maximum score of 5. Factor 3 of step 1 is susceptibility to cleanup or abatement. A score of 1 is assigned if less than half the discharge is susceptible to cleanup or abatement, or if the discharger failed to clean up 50% or more of the discharge within a reasonable period. Natural attenuation of discharge pollutants in the environment is not considered cleanup or abatement. Less than half of the discharge material was susceptible to cleanup or abatement given high flows following the discharge. This photo we received as part of the response to our investigative order shows site conditions about 3 months following the illicit activities. As you can see, the majority of fill material is underwater or has washed away. Here's a hydrograph of the West Walker upstream of the discharge site showing the height of the river at the time of violation in March 2019, rising to minor flood stage over 6 feet in June that year. This supports our application of a score of 1 for susceptibility to cleanup or abatement. This slide shows the first two steps of the penalty methodology. The dischargers have argued they should receive a high volume discharge discount. However, this is inappropriate given culpability and degree of harm caused. Additionally, this type of discount is intended to apply to accidental discharges such as sanitary sewer overflows. The initial liability is calculated based on the factors shown here. Continuing on, step 4 adjusts the liability with multipliers based on the violator's conduct. The range of potential scores are shown here in parentheses, and scores we've assigned are in bold. The degree of culpability is based on what a reasonable person would do. Mr. Park purportedly believed all environmental laws were suspended when Governor Newsom issued an emergency proclamation in February 2019. This is not a reasonable assumption, as a reasonable person would have exercised due diligence in ascertaining whether an emergency exempts them from obtaining a permit for work in natural streams, which it does not. The enforcement policy states that if the discharger has a prior history of violations within the last 5 years, the board should use a multiplier of 1.1. While the prosecution team has recently become aware of evidence indicating Mr. Park may have engaged in similar illegal activities in the recent past, the dischargers do not have a history of adjudicated violations. Oh, no, we got to go back one. Sorry. Yeah.
Alonso, let's stop the timer while AGP, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Okay. The cleanup and cooperation factor reflects the extent to which a discharger voluntarily corrects environmental damage and returns to compliance following a violation. In our April 2019 notice of violation, we recommended the discharger stabilize the disturbed riverbanks and provide a long-term restoration plan for the site. While the dischargers communicated with staff regarding proposed immediate measures to stabilize material, they failed to provide the long-term restoration plan requested. We derived the total base liability from multiplying the initial liability by the factors in step 4. Step 6 accounts for the dischargers' ability to pay the liability and continue in business. We conducted a search of the discharger's land assets, which total over $5 million, in addition to issuing a subpoena for financial documents. The enforcement policy provides that if a discharger fails to respond to a subpoena, which was the case here, the Water Board should treat that as an admission they're able to pay the liability and continue in business. The economic benefit analysis in step 7 sets a minimum liability to ensure a discharger doesn't financially benefit by violating regulations. In this case, we calculated the cost of a bank stabilization project consistent with the kind of 401 we could have issued. The economic benefit amount is not added to the liability, rather it sets the floor. For step 8, the prosecution team calculated staff costs incurred prior to ACL issuance. Please note this value is very conservative. Step 9 sets a range of potential liability derived from the water code and enforcement policy. Step 10 is the final liability we're proposing today that accounts for all applicable adjustment factors. We are bringing this action to you today because of the impacts to water quality and to serve as a deterrent against future discharges such as this. Water quality was heavily impacted due to the scale of disturbance and mass destruction of habitat. This violation was the largest and most egregious dredge and fill violation I've witnessed in my 8 years at the board. Enforcement like this serves as a strong deterrent against future violations and blatant disregard for our regulations. We are also specifically concerned about previously unpermitted modifications to stream and wetlands in this area. Astoundingly, a review of historical satellite imagery in the Antelope Valley has yielded evidence of riparian wetlands being converted to tilled agricultural production lands on several parcels owned by Park Livestock Co. It's clear that riparian wetlands adjacent to the West Walker have been routinely leveled for ag uses over the past couple decades. Here's a satellite image from 2006 where a portion of the West Walker is diverted to supply Topaz Lake. The diverted portion of the river is shown with the blue arrow and looks like a typical conveyance ditch. The natural portion of the river that continues downstream is shown with the red arrow. You can see a number of adjacent riparian wetland habitat features. This image from 2016 depicts the transformation of riparian wetlands from highly valuable habitat to tilled fields. I estimate roughly 70 acres of wetlands were converted as a result of this activity. If this work were permissible and a 401 certification were obtained, the cost to purchase replacement wetland credits consistent with California's no net loss policy could easily exceed $20 million. Here's an image of the same area from just last year that shows the West Walker River was straightened in several sections. This image shows property ownership associated with the parcel highlighted in previous slides. As you can see in the table at the bottom, this parcel is owned at least in part by Park Livestock Co. Let's take another look. 2006, 2016, 2023. Here is another parcel of land in the Antelope Valley near the town of Topaz. This image from 2005 shows a nice wetland complex east of the West Walker. You can see the same parcel in 2019 where wetlands have been destroyed and replaced by tilled fields. The southeast boundaries of work coincide exactly with Park Livestock Co.'s parcel boundaries. This image shows Park Livestock Co. owns the modified lands depicted in the two previous slides. Given how routinely this type of illicit work is conducted on his lands, Mr. Park's excuse of operating under an emergency exemption in March 2019 is exceedingly difficult to believe. An estimated 90% of California's historical wetlands and riparian areas have been lost since European colonization. And remaining riparian areas are threatened by illegal activities such as those discussed today. We play a critical role in protecting aquatic resources in our state, and enforcement like this is an important tool for ensuring dischargers play by the rules. Therefore, we recommend you adopt or raise the proposed penalty of $3,053,026.42. This concludes our presentation, and we can now take any questions you may have.
Ms. Van Diepen and the prosecution team, just want to point out you have about 10 minutes left on your time.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Does the board have any questions for the prosecution team? Dr. Cox.
Thank you. Liz, you had mentioned previously that there had been flooding in this area. How long did the flooding occur prior to this land disturbance?
Sorry, which flooding were you referencing?
In this area. It was a high rain year, I think, at that point in time. You had referenced that there had been flooding in that area.
Yeah, I spoke about flooding that occurred after the violation occurred. So Mr. Park was trying to protect his lands from erosion in anticipation of upcoming flooding in 2019, because that was a large winter.
There was no flooding prior to the land disturbance.
There has been flooding historically.
Okay. But nothing in 2019 prior to that work?
That's correct. Yeah, in 2019, prior to the work, the flows were kind of at a seasonal low that you would expect that time of the year.
Okay. It was mentioned that the high turbidity harms the fish. Was this during spawning season, or can you help me understand at what point in time in, you know, the fish life cycle did this occur?
I know there's a number of fish species that reside in that river, and I don't fully know the life cycle of all of those species.
Okay, so we don't think it was during spawning season?
Ben Lutton, Assistant Executive Officer. I have taken the oath. The violations occurred in March. And typically, I am no biologist, by the way, I'm a geologist, but I happen to know that spawning typically occurs in the spring for resident trout. But you should keep in mind that the harm caused by turbidity and fine sediment just isn't isolated just to spawning, but also can affect adult resident fish as well.
Okay. And do we know how many trees were removed as part of this activity?
I don't know exactly how many. I know some of the photos show some removed trees, and the California Department of Fish and Wildlife's report also indicated removal of mature trees.
Okay, thank you. That's all I have, Madam Chair.
Let's see if any other board members have any questions. Mr. Deaver?
I want to talk about slide 35, if you could bring that up, or just right there. I must have missed it. What was the date that photo was taken?
That photo was taken on March 19th, 2019, the day that the warden halted work out there.
Mustafavi.
No questions. Thank you.
Dr. Pierce, do you have any questions?
No questions.
Thank you. Let's see if the advisory team has any questions.
No questions from the advisory team.
Okay. Do the respondents wish to cross-examine the prosecution team witnesses? If so, would you like to cross-examine the witnesses now? Let's see. No, I guess we are concluded with the prosecution team's testimony, so this would be a time to cross-examine witnesses.
Chair Horn, before that question procedurally, are you interested in any objections about the presentation that you just heard?
Yes, you can maybe proceed with the objections.
Thank you. The respondents would move to strike the testimony from Ms. Van Diepen from slides 46 onward. These discussions about alleged activities on other parcels were never referenced in the ACL complaint. It's never referenced in their anything that was submitted pursuant to the procedure rules in their case in chief. Much of the testimony we heard right now, I heard no foundation for any of it, and we're hearing it for the first time today, notwithstanding any reference to it in a rebuttal brief that was not specifically identified in the hearing procedures.
And I'd like to respond to that if possible. This is Naomi Kaplowitz, Naomi Rubin for the prosecution team. The objections to those items of evidence were made when we submitted our rebuttal package, which they were included in. And in fact, the advisory team has issued a ruling on those specific items of evidence, and they are directly relevant to the discharger's arguments that Mr. Park thought he was acting under an emergency exemption and that environmental laws didn't apply to him when he performed the work on the subject parcel, the parcel that is the subject of this proceeding. We are using these evidentiary items to show that it is very difficult to believe that he thought he was acting under an emergency exemption, unless one is to believe that every time he does this work on other parcels, he also thinks he is operating under emergency exemptions. Thank you.
Board Chair, can you give us just one moment to review those slides?
Certainly. May I clarify one thing? The original objection that Ms. Rubin referenced was based on unlawful rebuttal testimony. I assumed that if they were going to enter unlawful rebuttal testimony, they would lay a foundation for those exhibits. They did not. There is no foundation. I don't know who pulled them. I don't know. It's labeled wetland habitat. Those are trees, if not ponds. I don't know who labeled it. I don't know who pulled it. I don't know when Park started owning that land. I don't know when he finished. There's just simply no information to lay a foundation for those items. So it's a completely different objection. And I would ask this board to consider it. No one has laid a foundation, and we don't have enough information to understand what's going on.
Council will advise, please.
Prosecution team, can you just confirm what rebuttal exhibit numbers those are in the slides?
Yeah, just give us one moment.
Sorry, can you turn on your microphone?
Sorry about that. It's prosecution team rebuttal exhibits 51 through 55. And I would also like to point out that opposing counsel did have a chance to raise foundational objections at the time that objections on rebuttal evidence were due, and the advisory team did rule on that issue as well. And if foundation is a problem, we can lay that foundation right here. It'll take 1 minute. Oh, and 59, I'm sorry, prosecution team rebuttal exhibits 59 and 60 as well.
Jonathan Mars for respondents. And just to be clear, there's a distinction between photographs, which the objection still stands to, as well as testimony that was just heard.
I'm sorry, can you clarify that? You said there's a distinction. Are you making an objection to both?
Yes.
Board Chair, are you ready?
Yes.
Board Chair, I'd recommend that you overrule the objections as to the admissibility of the rebuttal exhibits. The Board Chair, you already made a ruling on that, and that those objections previously already included foundational objections. And regarding the oral testimony, our hearing procedures and our regulations don't require pre-submittal of oral testimony. So I would recommend that the board overrule the objections.
Can you repeat what you said about the foundational material information? Your mask kind of makes it hard to understand.
Respondents already objected to the rebuttal exhibits for lacking foundation, and you made a ruling overruling those objections. And then regarding the oral testimony, we also recommend overruling that objection because this proceeding doesn't require pre-submittal of oral testimony.
Okay, based on the advice of counsel, I overrule both objections.
Thank you, Your Honor. Or, sorry, Chair Horn.
Okay. Oh, Your Honor, sure, I'll take it. All right, sorry. Next. Now, have I asked the advisory team if you have any questions?
I believe you have, but we don't have any questions.
Okay. Do the respondents wish to cross-examine the prosecution team witnesses?
No, Chair Horn, given the time available and the closing remarks that we have, we will not cross-examine anyone, but we are happy to move into our closing arguments and discussion with our witnesses.
Okay, in that case, this seems like a good time for a 10-minute break, and then we will resume with your testimony.
Thank you.
Everyone ready? Okay. We will now hear from the respondents and their witnesses.
Are you ready for me? Thank you. Good morning, members of the board. I'm Valerie Kincaid, counsel for respondents David Park and Park Livestock Company. I'm joined here by my co-counsel, Jonathan Mars. Also with us are Mr. Park, Marianne Martin, Park's general counsel, and Robert Anderson, an engineer and certified floodplain manager, retained to assist Park in responding to the board in this matter. You will hear from Mr. Park and Mr. Anderson shortly. I would like to thank you for your time and attention and consideration of our closing presentation today. This is a serious affair. The prosecution team is seeking your endorsement of a proposed multi-million dollar penalty against Park Livestock, a penalty of more than $3 million, which we understand would be the highest civil penalty ever imposed by this board. And what is the penalty for? More than 5 years ago, Park attempted to fortify the banks of the West Walker River near his property to mitigate significant erosion and loss of infrastructure that occurred in the area from high flood flow events. Park's bank fortification activities did not take place for years, months, or even weeks. They took place over a 1.5-day period in March 2019, during a time when Mono County was under a declared state of emergency for flooding, and wherein the emergency declaration specifically called for erosion control and fortification actions. $3 million for 1.5 days of erosion control work called for in the emergency declaration in place. Before we proceed too much further, I want to make it clear. Park understands the bank stabilization work may have constituted a stream bed alteration. Park accepts that he may have needed to approach the erosion mitigation control efforts differently, specifically by obtaining a stream bed alteration agreement with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. He does not deny that. So this is not a matter of a willfully defiant individual who flouts rules or responsibilities. To the contrary, the evidence in the record demonstrates the bank stabilization work stopped as soon as Park was contacted by Warden Elliott from Fish and Wildlife. Warden Elliott testified at his deposition that Park was fully cooperative and agreed to a follow-up site inspection by Fish and Wildlife about a week later. The evidence in the record also shows that Park acted quickly to obtain permits he understood from Fish and Wildlife were necessary for the erosion control work. The evidence shows that by March 29th, 2019, just 9 days after Park was first contacted by Warden Elliott and 3 days after the Fish and Wildlife site inspection, Park submitted to Fish and Wildlife an application that he understood was necessary to permit the work that had been done. Unfortunately, Fish and Wildlife never responded to Park. Let me repeat that. Park was told by Fish and Wildlife that the bank stabilization work was improper because he did not have the required permit. And when Park promptly sought the permit, he was ignored. It would not be the last time a state agency ignored Park and his efforts to respond to and comply with agency direction.
On April 15th, 2019, a few weeks after the site inspection, the Lahontan Board issued a notice of violation that included recommended corrective actions. Within days of receiving that NOV, that notice of violation, Mr. Park's consultant, Rob Anderson, who is a licensed professional engineer, a certified floodplain manager, and a water rights surveyor, tried to contact Rob Tucker at the Lahontan Board to discuss the notice of violation's proposed corrective actions. The two exchanged voicemail messages for about a week, and then Mr. Tucker stopped responding to Mr. Anderson's calls altogether. Mr. Anderson tried to reach out to Mr. Tucker and also Ms. Van Diepen via email instead, but Mr. Anderson's emails were ignored. This was the second, but not the last time, a state agency ignored Park and his efforts to respond to and comply with agency direction. A few months later, on August 9th, 2019, the Lahontan Board issued an investigative order to Park Livestock. The investigative order required a preparation of a technical report by October 2019. Mr. Anderson performed the tasks requested and timely submitted a technical report that evaluated the impact of Park's erosion control work and concluded there was tremendous amounts of naturally occurring accretions and avulsions. And in light of these conditions, Park's activities did not result in a material or measurable acceleration of erosion or a material impact on downstream flow or sediment transport patterns, what has been referred to so far here as turbidity. In response to this report, board staff never contacted Mr. Anderson. They never contacted Mr. Park. They had no follow-up questions. Once again, a state agency ignored Park and his efforts to respond to and comply with their direction. I bring these points up now because what we just witnessed in the prosecution team's presentation was a disturbing mischaracterization of the laws applicable to this hearing, Park's response to agency inquiries, and Park's objections raised in this proceeding. This may not be a courtroom, but Park does have due process rights. The prosecution team's presentation worked hard to gloss over the staff's and the prosecution team's various violations of Park's due process rights leading up to this hearing today, and that continue to prejudice Park in this matter. From the prosecution team's failure to demonstrate it had Park's knowing and informed consent to enter his property and conduct a site inspection, to the failure to demonstrate a proper separation of functions, to the prosecution team's failure to comply with hearing procedures in this matter, to the prosecution team's reliance on opinions from unqualified witnesses, it is clear that the prosecution team has not treated this case with the seriousness that it deserves. The prosecution blames Park for its shortcomings. However, it is the prosecution team that has the burden in this matter, and it is the prosecution team that has failed to support its allegations. The prosecution team provided a slide earlier, slide 8, that includes a picture of a house. And in this slide, the prosecution team concedes it is its burden to establish, first, a regulatory foundation, second, factual pillars or framing, and third, to follow the legal rules. We will walk you through each component of the structure and how the prosecution team failed to build each structure correctly. However, before we do that, it's important to remember that this entire structure relies on a single 2-hour site inspection. Ms. Van Diepen and Ms. O'Keefe accompanied Department of Fish and Wildlife on a site inspection that lasted 2 hours and never went back. Mr. Letton, who's here and submitted a declaration, has never been to the site. Mr. Myers, who you heard from today, has also never once been to the site. This site visit is shockingly undocumented. There are no notes from DFW in the record. Absolutely no notation from DFW in the record in this matter. Ms. Van Diepen took no notes while she was out there and failed to come back and make a single notation about this matter. There are no notes from Ms. Van Diepen. The only documentation of this single 2-hour visit is one single piece of redacted scratch paper from Ms. O'Keefe, who the prosecution team called, but only to validate timestamps on photos. There is not one regional board or DFW recorded measurement. There is no measurement of length, height, or width in this case, not one. No recorded single GPS coordinate. Took no single GPS coordinates while they're out there, even though they had a GPS coordinate device. They did not take a single soil sample. They did not take a single water sample. They did not measure for turbidity. And there is no evidence of fish and wildlife, not a single picture, and not a single notation documenting any harm. In order to build this house, the prosecution team needed to prove, first, they had affirmative and informed consent to enter the property. Second, they needed to provide facts and data that supports there was a discharge of pollutants to a water of the United States. They needed to provide facts and data that support alleged toxicity. They needed to provide facts and data supporting alleged harm. They needed to provide facts and data that support the volume of the material allegedly discharged. They have none of it. We will walk you through each of these failures in closing today and explain how the prosecution team failed to lay the regulatory foundation. They failed to provide facts and evidence required to support their allegations, and they failed to comply with the legal rules that govern this procedure. They failed completely to build this house. We plan to call two witnesses today to attest to their declaration. And right now we will start with Mr. Park. I apologize for the awkwardness here, but you can look at the board or me. Good morning, sir. Can you please state your name for the record and confirm that you've taken the oath in this matter?
Good morning, David Park, and I am under oath.
Thank you. And can you tell us a little bit about you and Park Livestock?
Sure. I'm a fifth generation rancher in the area. My family has raised cattle for 150 years in this area and going clear back to around 1865.
Great. And can you tell us briefly what led up to the events that brought us here today?
Sure. I recognize that 20 plus years of issues with the river and continued erosion throughout the system. And I was concerned about the high runoff from that spring, that it was going to continue to do damage, as evident, as you can see, in what it did to the property with our fences, our fields, our irrigation system. So I thought it was prudent for myself to protect our private property and by means of erosion control.
Great. Thank you. Did you provide a declaration in this matter, Mr. Park?
I did.
And have you reviewed it recently?
I have.
And can you attest to its accuracy?
Yes.
Great. Can you turn to paragraph 9 and please read that paragraph aloud?
Sure. Paragraph 9 reads, prior to the site inspection, I had not spoken with Lahontan Board representatives about this matter or provided Lahontan Board with permission to access the Park Livestock property or conduct a site inspection. I do not recall anyone at the site inspection identifying themselves as Lahontan Board representatives or identifying anyone else at the site inspection as a Lahontan Board representative.
Right. And in case anyone's confused about what exactly you're saying in this paragraph, can you clarify whether during the Fish and Wildlife site inspection on March 25th, you understood that any other agency was participating in the Fish and Wildlife site inspection?
I did not.
To the best of your recollection, on March 25th, did anyone identify themselves as being from the Lahontan Board?
No.
Did anyone identify anyone else as being from the Lahontan Water Board?
No.
Did anyone show you a Lahontan Water Board badge?
No.
Did anyone give you a Lahontan Water Board business card?
No.
Did anyone give you a Lahontan Water Board case number?
No.
Did you notice any vehicles marked with Lahontan Water Board?
No.
Did you notice anyone wearing a Lahontan Water Board clothing, windbreaker, hat?
No.
Did anyone say there was a concern of a discharge of alleged pollutants into the West Walker River that was within the Lahontan Water Board's jurisdiction that day?
No.
And did anyone from the board, the Lahontan Water Board, specifically ask your consent to access your property?
No.
To the best of your knowledge, when did you first become aware that the Lahontan Water Board had taken an interest in your erosion control activities?
I have received a notice of violation after the incident.
Okay, and is that the first time that you understood the Lahontan Board was investigating your erosion control activities?
It is.
And did you try to be cooperative with Fish and Wildlife when you were first contacted during Fish and Wildlife site inspection?
I did.
And why was that?
Because I have a working relationship with the local Fish and Wildlife. Particularly, though, we were in the process of going through a application for the permit. And secondarily is, you know, over the years, we've had communication with them on other instances of like trespassing from fishermen to hunters. So we've had communication with these people and we wanted to keep that relationship.
Great, thank you. And do you have the opportunity to work with other agencies on any conservation projects?
I have.
And can you explain what conservation projects you've completed and which ones are in process?
Sure. Just recently, we've put a conservation easement on a piece of property in Smith Valley, Nevada. It was referred to as the Desert Creek. That's our ranch. It's for the purposes of, you know, for the habitat of the sage grouse in that area. Also, we've had, we've put a conservation easement actually on 6,000 acres of our property in Douglas County in Antelope Valley, which is includes about 5 or 6 mile corridor of the West Walker River. We are also working with NDEP and the Corps of Engineers on another project in Carson Valley, Nevada, on the East Fork of the Carson River. Again, it's another stream bank restoration project that goes through our property. In addition, we've also been working on a project up in Markleyville, California with DWF for the purposes of another conservation component, which includes public access to the river so that people can fish the river. Last, we have been working with a conservation group in Antelope Valley, just upstream of this site. And the collaboration is acquiring properties so that the conservation may hold the properties that are on the river corridor for the purposes of public access.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Park. And earlier today, Ms. Van Diepen described the West Walker River as a freestone river, which she explained as having no upper structures in the river. Do you understand that to be the case?
Not at all.
And can you explain if there are structures in the river upstream?
Yes, there's two significant diversion structures in the river, one referred to the Swagger Dam, and the other one is the Big Slough. Other than that, though, there is other rock-made dams that are for smaller diversions. But between those two diversions, that is approximately 90% of all the water diversion for the irrigation in Antelope Valley.
Thank you, Mr. Park. That's it for me. Now I'll move on to Mr. Anderson. Good morning, Mr. Anderson. Can you please state your name for the record?
Hold on a second. Let's see if board members have any questions of Mr. Park.
Sure.
Questions? Well, I have a question for Mr. Park. So in the materials that respondents provided, you stated that, or it was stated, that between 1993 and 1998, the West Walker River changed course and began avulsing into adjacent agricultural lands by 50 to 70 feet. And from just June 2016 to October 2018, the river had moved as much as 145 feet further into those lands. If you were concerned about the river changing course and wanted to protect your agricultural lands, why didn't you apply for a permit when high water flow damaged your property by undercutting banks and losing grazing land and damaged the fencing 2 years prior to 2019?
Well, exactly. And it wasn't until 2 years prior to that we started having noticing damage to the fencing and property and fields and irrigation ditches.
Well, it seems like in 2 years you had plenty of time to reach out to the Lahontan Board and the Army Corps of Engineers and find out about requiring permits and bank stabilization procedures that you could do to prevent damage, protect your lands.
Yeah, at the time I didn't consider that. It wasn't until it appeared to be in an emergency situation for me when we knew that there's going to be high flows in that spring of 19.
But even so, when did the high flows occur? And they were later than March, so you still could have applied for a permit before actually undertaking the activity.
Yeah. However, we did not and didn't feel that there was a need to do so. I mean, my understanding is this is not a WOTUS river.
We'll get to that with Mr. Anderson. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Anderson. Will you please state your name for the record and affirm that you've taken the oath?
Yes. Good morning. My name is Robert Anderson, and yes, I've taken the oath.
Thank you. Can you tell us a little bit about you and your background?
Certainly. I'm a licensed professional engineer registered in the state of California, Nevada, Washington, Texas, and Missouri. I am the principal engineer, I have been the principal engineer in my firm for 35 years. I've been practicing civil engineering in Northern Nevada and Eastern California for a little over 40 years now. Our firm was recently acquired, and I remain a principal engineer with the new firm at this time.
Thank you. And can you explain whether you have any specific certifications?
Yes, I'm a certified, registered professional engineer in those states I mentioned. In addition, I'm a certified floodplain manager and a Nevada water rights surveyor.
Thank you. Mr. Anderson, can you tell us briefly about your involvement in this matter?
Certainly. Mr. Park, who has been a client of ours and his family over the years, contacted me and explained to me that he had received the notice of violation from the state board. He asked to meet. He and I arranged a meeting right away. It was relatively, in his statements to me, it was an urgent matter. So we arranged the meeting that day, actually. And the following date, as I recall, at 6 o'clock in the morning, we made a site visit so that I could personally review the conditions on the river and begin assessing what needed to be done or what could be done.
Thank you. And was there a time in your work where you tried to work with the Lahontan Regional Board but had difficulty doing so?
Excuse me. Yes, our firm regularly prepares bank stabilization projects along the various rivers in Northern Nevada and Eastern California, including the Walker River, both the East and West Forks, as well as the East and West Fork of the Carson River, and also the Carson River main stem from Carson Valley to Lahontan. We've been retained by both state state agencies as well as landowners to provide those services. As a result, I have considerable experience in these types of activities and the importance of them. As a result, my observation at the time when David and I made the first site visit was that there was an opportunity to, with some urgency to go in and stabilize the banks. The banks at that time were vertical, where the river had eroded and cut into and beneath the fences and agricultural lands that Mr. Park testified to. There was, in my opinion, an opportunity if we move quickly to proceed and accomplish those things. So I reached out to Mr. Tucker attempting to make such an arrangement so that we could proceed with some urgency.
And did you ever, between your phone calls and emails, did you ever get actually in contact with anyone at the Lahontan Board?
No, we did not. After several attempts, we were not able to make contact either with Mr. Tucker or Ms. Van Diepen.
And is that because they stopped returning phone calls and never returned emails?
That is correct.
Did you provide a declaration in this matter?
Yes, I did.
And have you reviewed it recently?
Yes, in preparation for my testimony today.
Can you attest to the accuracy here today?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and can you briefly summarize the opinions that you expressed in your declaration?
There are numerous opinions that are included within my deposition, or actually my declaration. My deposition was not taken, but relative to, a significant portion of my declaration relates to the Water Board's estimate of the volume of fill that was actually allegedly discharged into the river. It also summarizes our hydrologic and hydraulic analysis of the channel and the historic flows within the West Fork of the Walker River. But there's a substantial portion of it that documents topographic surveys, aerial imagery that we had collected, both historically, as Board Member Cox had referenced earlier in her questions, we had actually obtained those documents and to demonstrate the amount of accretion and avulsion that has occurred in this reach.
Thank you. And did you have any criticisms of the volume calculations prepared by the prosecution team in this matter?
We did. After reviewing those volume calculations, and so that everybody is clear, we were asked to, in the notice of violation and the requirement for a technical report did specifically state that we needed to make an estimate. In my professional opinion, and based on my 40 plus years of experience, I believe that was an impossible task for the reasons I'm going to, I have attested to in the declaration. And it was an infeasible task and could not be done with a measure of accuracy that would be necessary and appropriate for a hearing of this magnitude or an instance of this magnitude. But specifically relative to our criticisms of the calculations that were performed and submitted by the Water Board's representatives, the first one we noted was the effect of errors in estimating distances. As was testified to earlier by Mr. Myers, he utilized GIS, which sounds like it's very precise and so forth, and can be if those photographs and those documents are photorectified, and these particular ones are not. But the introduction of those errors, when you make an estimate of length or depth, there is an error associated with it, and those errors compound. So if you were 10% wrong on the first estimate, so you're 90% accuracy, and then you had another estimate, and you were equally 10% wrong on that one, all of a sudden you have an introduction of an error of over of 19%, which is approaching 20%. And so the compounding effect of that, and some of these distances and the polygons that were traced by the board staff had 15 legs to them. And if you start adding those up and starting the potential error that's introduced by 15 legs, which are estimated, you have a gross estimate. I mean, it barely qualifies, in my opinion, as an estimate. Also, the board staff used the average depth of that fill. That in a natural channel, I think that is a very gross it's a gross method. I realize that they have characterized it as being very conservative, but in a natural channel, in my opinion, that is inappropriate to make that estimate and then to use it and rely on it to make an assessment of a fine of the order of magnitude that is presented in this case, I think is just grossly irresponsible, frankly. Additionally, the estimates review of photography that was taken. Unfortunately, there's no measurement to those photographs. They're just photographs taken at an undefined distance of what would be then what were then estimated to of heights and lengths and widths. But all of these introduce potential errors and again draw into question the validity of the estimate that was finally derived. We were also the aerial imagery that was used from September 2018 was not necessarily representative of the conditions that were present at the site. Actually, the very best evidence would have been measurements that would have been taken by the board staff when they made their site visit. It's my understanding from reading through the depositions in this matter that they were equipped with tape measures, they were equipped with GPS. They could have measured the area of impact, but in fact failed to. And so the use of aerial imagery some 6 months prior to the actual event, in my opinion, was inappropriate. Specifically, the board staff used a polygon method, or what they refer to as a polygon method, to come up with these areas. That method is not defined in any literature. It is not defined. It is not a recognized method, an accepted method for making hydrologic calculations or hydraulic calculations in a river or stream bed instance. And as a result, it's an assumption. It's a means to try to, it appears to be a means to attempt to quantify something that otherwise hasn't been quantified properly. The measurements, and again, the estimate fails to discount the volume by the porosity of the soils. We specifically cited in the declaration a study that was done, I forget the university, but it's in the record for you, that where they had done a study and they had shown where equipment had driven over and actually compacted in a stream bed the soils that were underneath the system, and they had measured the porosity, and that porosity was determined to be at a mean value of about 40%. Staff failed to discount this volume in their estimate by the porosity of the soils. If you look closely at the figures and the photographs that were included with in the notice of violation, you will see that there's a significant portion of those soils that are, despite the testimony you heard earlier today, there's a significant portion of those soils that are not saturated at the time Mr. Park conducted his operation. So to be dismissive of the porosity because of assumption that it is there's water within the soils is inappropriate, and I think without foundation. Finally, they use the displacement ratio method for calculating these volumes. The displacement method is understood and accepted to be essentially of taking a bucket of water, a sphere that is non-porous, has a solid sphere, placing it and dunking it into that volume of water, and then you measure the distance and the depth or the volume of what it increases, and that becomes the volume. In this instance, that is the exact method that was utilized. It's cited in their documentation, and that's inappropriate. Again, because there is porosity in these soils, those factors are not applicable, and therefore that methodology is inappropriate, in my professional opinion. And then finally, the board staff attempted to correlate their results to a statement we made in our report, and the chairman, you just referenced that statement where there was, in our estimation, based on actual evaluation of LIDAR topographical survey compared to that was gathered in 2008 compared to the actual physical survey that our firm prepared in September of, I believe, 2020, if I'm not mistaken. And that topograph, when you compare that, you would find that there was over, in that period of time, we estimated that there were 17,300 cubic yards of material that was removed from the banks and passed downstreams. So it's remarkable to me as a practitioner that there is not more concern for the natural accretion and avulsion that occurs in these streams and the effect that it has on wildlife and it has on fisheries and so forth. But that volume, 17,300 cubic yards in a period of 8 years, is about 1,900 cubic yards per year that occurs. Coincidentally, I would say they came up with, the board staff came up with a similar volume. That is not appropriate. Those volumes occurred and with varying degrees of flood flows in the river. And I think there is no correlation, in my professional opinion, between the estimate that the board staff derived and the number and the volume of material that was transported by accretion or avulsion within the river system from 2008 to 2018 or 19. So those are some of my criticisms.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Anderson. That's very helpful. You just spoke a little bit about porosity. Are you aware that the prosecution team has a little bit of a different view on porosity?
Yes, I have learned that in preparation for today's testimony.
And can you explain their view and whether you agree with it?
The prosecution team has presented a paper that appeared in the, I think it is in the, I have it with me, but the sedimentology journal. And it speaks specifically to the spatial variation in river bed porosity determined by nuclear density gauging. And it was a study conducted in apparently in France. It goes through a very detailed and I would say, a very detailed technical analysis of porosity. A big portion of the analysis that was presented is whether or not it's the efficacy, frankly, of utilizing nuclear density gauges for measuring just the measurement of porosity. It goes through and it makes certain determinations based on the measurements that they were taken as to how frequent the tests need to be occurred to have any correlation to porosity. It goes through and it estimates porosity, and it ranges from 15 to depending maybe even as much as 30 or 35% that they determined in that particular environment. It goes through and it attempts to, but cannot and does not actually find a correlation between sediment types and porosity. So it's, in my estimation, in my judgment, it is not specific and not germane, particularly to the questions that are posed in this particular hearing.
Thank you. And even if the prosecution team's volume analysis that porosity should be discounted between 15 and 40%, even if you did that, would if you corrected for that error, would that result in a reliable fill material calculation in this matter?
Not in my professional opinion.
And Mr. Anderson, during the prosecution team's presentation, slide 7, I believe, there was a claim that despite being ordered, discharge refused to provide a volume estimate. So staff had to investigate further. Can you explain exactly, you know, that in general high-level terms, what your technical report did provide, and go from there?
Sure. Excuse me. Our technical report did evaluate available topographic data prior to the event. There was no topographic data, publicly available topographic data, in immediate proximity to the date that the alleged violation occurred. And as a result, we went back, obtained the most recent data, which was 2008. And then we, because of the conditions at the time of the notice of violation and the high flood flows or high flows that were going to occur in the river, it was unsafe to place my surveyors at risk and have them go and do attempt to do a topographic survey of the bed and the channel and there at that time, and therefore make an appropriate estimate. As a result, we used the 2008 data. We finally were able to get into the river in September of 2019. We made a topographic survey of it and then compared the two values to determine the estimated flows. I did not, as a professional engineer, our board looks dimly on guessing on volumes. We are not in the habit of guessing to make estimates. It is not something that we would do for any client. And I particularly would not send it to a state agency with a guess in the order of magnitude of this sum. So for that reason, as I stated in my testimony earlier today, I don't believe it was an appropriate question. It was an impossibility to answer. To answer in a professional manner, and one in which would be, at least in my mind, in my professional experience as a registered engineer in the state of California, something that would be accepted.
Thank you. And Mr. Anderson, can you talk a little bit about the significance of the naturally occurring activity in this area and what that does to the volume calculations presented by the prosecution team and that they put before the board?
Certainly. The natural occurring processes of accretion and avulsion that occur in this segment of the river are significant. And that is evidenced by the photographic evidence that was presented in our technical report. It's a significant volume of material, as I testified earlier, could be as much as 2,000 cubic yards per per year that we calculated that gets moved. That's not trivial. As part of this, when Mr. Park and I first visited, and it's included in my report, we, understanding the importance of turbidity and its effect on, you know, invertebrates and salmon, or excuse me, the various fisheries that might exist, we immediately commenced taking regular samples of the turbidity, both upstream of the action or the area of action and downstream. Those are reported in my technical report. It's only somewhat surprising to me that nobody so far in the testimony that I've seen has acknowledged the fact that those tests were taken weekly. They were taken over a period of 12 consecutive weeks. They demonstrate the turbidity did not vary by more than 7% in this reach over that period of time. And so I believe that the existing riverine environment, because of the accretion and avulsion that occurs, being it's still, while it's a mild slope, it is still a relatively significant slope. There's energy in the river, and that is causing that accretion and avulsion. But yet there's been no acknowledgement that the turbidity, the actual physical turbidity tests that were taken and collected and reported, they've essentially, it seems to me, the staff has provided no weight to those tests.
Thank you. In your professional opinion, is the volumetric calculation offered by the prosecution team the type of information upon which a responsible person could rely?
It is not.
And as a certified engineer, if someone in your office brought this volumetric calculation to you, would you put your engineer's certification stamp on this?
I would not.
Thank you. That's it from me, Mr. Anderson.
Let's see if there are any questions for Mr. Anderson. Dr.
So when you first started your introduction, it was about timing, and you had stated that you met with Mr. Park. It seemed urgent. It was after the NOV was issued. You saw the site and the vertical banks and the accretion and avulsion that occurred. Hadn't that already been repaired at that time? Or help me understand the timing of your introductory remarks.
Certainly. So at the time of my site visit with Mr. Park, he had ceased, as the testimony was given to you earlier, when the game warden asked him to stop, he stopped. As a result, there were the project was not completed. There were still vertical banks that were left over from prior flood events that had caused them to fail, they became unstable, and so those were still present and visible on the site. There additionally, you know, as the photographic evidence showed, there was areas where he didn't complete the movement of the dirt, so there's small piles, as was referenced earlier, and so that is the condition in which I witnessed it that first site visit.
So that still existed?
Yes, ma'am.
And during your evaluation and the time period from the NOV to now, you have no estimated volume of material?
Is it Dr. Cox? I want to be sure. Dr. Cox, please understand that to make those types of estimates, and to do them with the level of professionalism that is required to submit to a state board of this, frankly, of this significance, one needs topographic data before it happened and after it happened. We do not have that in this instance. You know, I was provided with a copy of the rebuttal statement that was made by staff. They acknowledged to do the methods that we described in our report, it needed topographic data. The best time to have collected that data was when staff was on site and before the river rose. But it took months for the order to come out that required a technical analysis. And therefore, despite our efforts to make those calls to try to move the project forward and see if there was some emergency work to get done, those were largely, I don't want to say ignored, but they were unanswered. And as a result, there's no data.
Okay, but you had mentioned that about 17,000 cubic yards is naturally removed and sent downstream.
Yes, ma'am.
By these flood events, how was that amount determined?
So there's a LIDAR survey in Antelope Valley dated in 2018. Mm-hmm. And when the river flows abated to a point where I could safely put my surveyors in the riverbed, we did that. And we made a detailed survey by professional land surveyors registered in the state of California to make that survey. We then compared those two digital terrain models and determined the 17,800 cubic yards over a period of 8 years.
So the determination was from the LIDAR in 2008, data that you assembled by your ground survey.
Yes, and that is why it is characterized as over an eight-year period. It's not intended to be specific to the activities Mr. Park undertook for those 2 days or portions of 2 days. It was just to give everybody involved an understanding and appreciation and amount of the accretion and avulsion that incurs in that segment of the river.
Okay. And there seems to be a lot of discussion about staff's non-responsiveness. Does the record bear the email communications that went unresponded to?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you. All I have.
Mr. Deaver.
Mr. Anderson, how many times did you try to contact staff at Lahontan?
I don't have my records.
Roughly
three or four.
And just ignored?
No, actually, Mr. Tucker did call me back. And I think my declaration states this. He did call me back. I missed him. I returned his call. I think he called me back one more time. I returned his call, and that was it.
So you never tried to come in person here when you first didn't get a response?
I did not.
Did you ever try to talk to your assemblyman about intervening in your behalf that the Lahontan staff wasn't responding?
Myself personally?
Yes.
No. As a professional engineer, our relationships with assemblymen are...
aren't that good? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Anderson? No?
Thank you.
Okay. I have a couple questions. Okay. So you mentioned that after you first visited the site and you saw the vertical banks and you were trying to reach the Lahontan staff to develop a plan for stabilizing the site as it existed, and you got no response. So my question is, after the activity that was done on March 18th and 19th, would bank stabilization done after the fact have cured the problem that was caused on those prior dates?
First of all, I would have, my observation at that time and my thinking at that time would have been to allow him to finish the work he was doing, provide some rock toe protection adjacent to the cut bank slope so that they would not continue to erode, provide some rock groins, some other measures to minimize the velocities and minimize the erosion potential of that reach. Those activities, I think the board staff has characterized them as about a $50,000 expense. Certainly, in hindsight, that $50,000 would have been a drop in the bucket compared to what has been spent to date.
So those activities would not have mitigated the damage they were done. They just would have prevented further damage. Is that what you're saying?
I'm not a biologist. So relative to the alleged damages, I can't quantify those or understand them. But I think it would have minimized the future or additional erosion potential. That's for certain.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Why didn't you submit a long-term restoration plan as requested in the investigative order?
At this time, as I sit here, to be honest with you, Madam Chairman, I do not recall why we did not submit one. I don't know if it was just the expansive time, the fact that by the time we revisited the river, it was actually had stabilized and the turbidity results confirmed that. I don't recall why we did not submit you know, further mitigation work. The mitigation that should have occurred should have been done immediately, in my professional opinion. Long-term, perhaps there's a benefit to it even now, but I did not submit one.
Thank you. And finally, in what state is Walker Lake located?
The state of Nevada.
And so if Walker Lake is a navigational water, as a jurisdictional water defined by the Army Corps of Engineers, how could the West Walker River, which is tributary to the Walker River, which is tributary to Walker Lake, not be an interstate water?
I believe it is an interstate water.
And that would make it a water of the U.S.?
I'm not qualified to make that assessment.
Okay. Thank you. No further questions from the board. Let's see if there are any questions from the advisory team.
There are none, Board Chair.
Okay. Where are we? I'm good. Does the prosecution team wish to cross-examine the respondents' witnesses?
Can I just clarify, Ms. Cade, was there an additional witness that you were going to call?
No, that we don't have another witness. And I'm unclear as to the, well, I'll let Chair Horn explore. Are you providing the prosecution team more time or...
I'm just going through this order that's in front, order of the hearing that's put in front of me.
I can answer that question. The prosecution team has around 10 minutes remaining. And as mentioned in the beginning, either party can choose how to use their 60 minutes of time. And so I believe the chair is now asking the prosecution team if they'd like to use any of that 10 minutes to cross-examine the respondents' witnesses.
Looking at the prosecution team.
Yeah, I just have a couple of questions for Mr. Anderson, and I'm wondering if it's possible to take a quick break after that before closing remarks as well.
Yes, probably.
Okay.
Your mic's off.
Sorry about that. One more procedural question. Would it be possible to bring up one of our exhibits on the PowerPoint?
Ask AGP folks, tell them what you need.
Okay, so maybe would it be possible then to just take a quick break now if people need to stretch their legs, and I'll work on the technical.
How long do you think, how much time will you need?
Like 5 minutes.
Okay.
And if I may, a point of clarification, is it correct that the assumption here is that the prosecution team has 10 more minutes total? Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
So maybe folks could stay in the room. We'll try to make this break as short as possible. Okay, I think we're getting ready to reconvene. Yes, Mr. Mars.
Can we just get a precise time remaining?
I was just about to ask the timer for that information.
Thank you
very much. Mr. Poach, what's the time?
I have prosecution team has 10 minutes and 28 seconds. Respondent team has 22 minutes and 15 seconds remaining.
Ms. Rubin, when you're ready to go.
Thank you very much. This is Naomi Rubin, counsel for the prosecution team. I'd like to cross-examine Mr. Anderson. And Mr. Anderson, you stated, we just heard testimony from you stating that the prosecution team's volume analysis is, you characterized it as based on guesses instead of estimates, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
And I'd like to put up on the screen a photograph, which is included in prosecution team rebuttal exhibit 2. And it was also used in
the volume analysis. Mr. Anderson, could you estimate the height of the woman in the photo?
Not from this perspective.
I think she is taller than 8 feet.
Taller than 8 feet?
Yeah.
No, I don't think she's taller than 8 feet.
Taller than 7 feet?
I doubt that.
Less than four feet?
No, she appears to be taller than that.
So could you estimate that she's between 4 feet and 7 feet tall?
Yeah, you could bracket that way if you chose.
Okay, thank you. That's all.
Okay, so let's see. Where are we now? Help me, counsel.
I believe the board could maybe ask questions of either party before we allow the public commenters to come in, or unless Ms. Kincaid seems to be standing up.
So the board members have, let's see if the board members have, wait a second, questions of Mr. Anderson or at this time?
Well, I'm just wondering, would it be acceptable or appropriate for Mr. Anderson to review with us that technical report? How would that work? Would that subsume all of their time, or could he hit some highlights of this technical report?
No, the board has questions for Mr. Anderson that won't go to the respondent's time.
So go ahead and ask your questions.
Well, I'm just curious if, you know, it would be possible to pull that exhibit 4 up on the screen and have you kind of walk through your assumptions and analyses.
I'm sorry, Dr. Costa, are you asking Mr. Anderson or to do that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. If that's possible.
It's on the FTP site. I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Because they have the turbidity sampling and that sort of thing that they've done in that area. If that's not appropriate, then that's fine.
I think go ahead and ask your question and we'll see whether or not respondents can answer the question.
To it, I'm looking at exhibit 4, figure 11. I'm wondering if you can describe that for us and what we are looking at here.
Is that question to me, Dr.
Yes, Buck? Yes, please.
Again, Rob Anderson for the record. I have a copy of my technical report before me that I will refer to. The figure 11 that that you reference is on page 15 of my report. Are we looking to the same
correct. One? That is correct.
So this figure 11 is the aerial imagery from the Esri digital order dated October 2018, overlaid with the results of our topographic survey, which was conducted in September of 2019. The yellow lines that are shown there are contour lines of equal elevation through the reach, and they show the, you know, if you are able to compare them, you can see the some of the differences there. It's easier done with a digital terrain model, but it's, you can visually see them here.
All right. We're going to attempt to get the exhibit on the screen so everybody can be looking at it. Let's just give us one moment.
Excuse me, is it possible that I could have a pointer? I think I could do a little better job of explaining it with a pointer.
Yeah, it's available with the clicker.
Will it show up on the screens? But that's not very helpful. Okay. Yeah. Laser pointer on these screens is not going to be.
It'll show up on our screens, but it won't show up on the Zoom, I think, is what happens. Mm-hmm. Point it at the screen and see if it shows up. Yeah.
Well, perhaps it does.
Very good. It just won't show up on the Zoom.
Okay.
Yes, if you could pull up the prosecution team exhibit 4, I believe that's the report that Mr. Anderson and board member Cox are looking at. Is this the correct exhibit that you're asking questions on?
Yes, it is.
You want to go to the PDF page 20.
Or figure 10. Okay, I think we're ready.
Okay. What's your question?
Can you explain this figure to us?
Certainly. Again, Rob Anderson for the record. This is our figure 10. It's the aerial imagery captured from ESRI dated July of 2012, overlaid with the LIDAR data from June of 2011. This figure, the contours that are shown, see there, these yellow lines are lines of equal elevation or contours. Here you can see the along these edges where there are heavy yellow lines, those areas where the vertical, there's a vertical bank, and it's not, if it were a 2-to-1 slope or a 3-to-1 slope, those lines would be separated. But these areas, as you will see, as you can see here, are very vertical. Whereas these areas here, you're spread out, these contours, this is a flatter bar area. This area here and the aerial imagery from was a bar that existed in 2012 inside the river channel. Again, the north and east bank of the river is essentially vertical. And then you see this topographical anomaly that is shown here, represented by, again, the LIDAR survey that's dated in 2011.
Okay, then can you move on to figure 11 and describe that for us?
So in figure 11, we use the same, or excuse me, we use the more recent topographic data, or excuse me, aerial imagery from October of 2018 from ESRI, and overlaid it with our topo from September of 2019. Again, very similarly, the yellow lines are representative of lines of equal elevation or contours, areas where there are steep banks appear to be heavy in yellow. So you'll see that here on the west border of this oxbow. You would also see it along this east border of this portion of the braided stream channel. These areas are areas of topography. Again, this is our topographic survey in September of 2019, which would be after the alleged discharge event. But you can, when it's overlaid on the 2018 imagery, you can see the large bar that had formed. This is part of the avulsion that, the accretion that's occurred from between the two images. You can see the bar here and the bar there. If you were to go back one image relatively quickly, you could see the difference to one exhibit up further. Back one page, there you go. So you see this bar in 2012 was relatively small. Go ahead and go down again. And then now what has occurred is the amount of accretion that has occurred as a result of just the natural forms between those two dates, which again, based on ours, is the aerial imagery is 2012 versus the aerial imagery in 2018. So over that 6-year period, this bar formed. The river was pushed into the north and east bank of the private property, causing these vertical banks that you saw in the earlier photographic evidence that was submitted. And again, you see here where the river has, through this turn, made this channel and now creating and moving to the west.
Okay, and can you go to table 2 on page 20 of the report? Um, I don't
keep going down.
This one
getting very close.
Doesn't right show me.
Yes, ma'am.
So, what was the purpose of the turbidity sampling? And these occurred from June of September, so a few months after stop work order.
So the stop work order, I believe, was issued in March of 19. I believe the requirement, the order requiring a technical report, was issued in June. We, as a result of my conversations with Mr. Park, he engaged us to, at my recommendation, to begin taking turbidity samples, both upstream and downstream of the location, to measure the relative turbidity between the two locations during what we expected to be high flow conditions within this segment of the river. So this table two, Dr. Cox, that you have referred to, provides that sampling data, and it provides it both upstream and downstream by date. It characterizes the flow that was present on the date of our measurements. So as you'll see there on June 7th, the flow had increased from about 475 when we made the site visit in April to 2,100 cubic feet per second on that date in June. We showed we took three samples upstream, we took three samples downstream, and then we averaged the upstream samples, compared it to the downstream samples. On June, we actually found that downstream the turbidity had been reduced by approximately 2%. And that is how this table reads for each of the 11 or 12 instances that we collected those samples.
And so what's the takeaway for the layperson?
For the layperson, the takeaway is there's virtually no increase to turbidity through the segment of the river during this period of time, no observed increase in turbidity between June 7th, 2019 to September 19, 2019. The change, the variation is less than 7% in every instance.
Okay. And then I think probably the last question I have is on figure 13, where you have the 50% annual chance of flood inundation. Was this a mapping of that segment of the river to determine where you may see additional erosion, or what was the purpose of that?
The purpose of this, let me get you my copy. I'm sorry, you said it's figure... It's
page 25, figure 13.
So as part of our analysis in the technical report, we were required to determine where at what discharge would be the what we would call the 50% chance of recurrence. That means it has in each and every year that discharge level would be expected to occur every other year. We take that, that's also sometimes referred to as a two-year discharge. We take that to be the ordinary high water mark, or the determination of the ordinary high water mark. You know, in general terms, obviously there's other factors. If you had a biologist or a botanist with you, they might find riparian vegetation in a different proximity. But for the purpose of this report and the hydraulic analysis, that we performed, this exhibit shows what we determined to be the 50% annual chance of flood inundation based on the LIDAR survey in 2011. So that the area that is shaded blue would, it is anticipated based on the historic river discharges that occurred just upstream of this, that the area in shaded blue would likely be, there's a 50% chance each year that that would be inundated in river runoff.
Okay, and then figure 14 is just an extension of that.
Figure 14 actually takes that flood inundation and applies it to that same discharge value. We rerun the hydraulic calculations and we show it based on the results of our topographic survey. You'll see there's a couple differences there. In particular, there are some between the topographic data that was available based on the LIDAR in 2011 that the volume of accretion, you can see the area that is tan in it, and I would show you that is this area here that I'm speaking to. That is above the water surface. So actually, there's been so much accretion in this reach of the river that it's actually formed, and you saw it. You, in fact, you can see it in underlying the level of material that's accumulated in this particular area, and then also in this area here. Those are higher than that discharge, the hydraulic elevation of that discharges.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate the indulgence, Chair.
I think with that, okay, help me, counsel. Are we ready to return to the respondent's testimony?
I believe that they have concluded their testimony.
We do have a closing that'll take about the remainder of our time. I'm happy to do that after the prosecution team if they have one.
Okay. That's the appropriate time then. Wait a second. I have to look at my notes here.
Sorry. Board Chair, I just wanted to clarify. There are also a couple of steps before closing statement, including letting the members of the public have an opportunity to speak and giving the prosecution team an opportunity for a rebuttal if they wish to have any rebuttal testimony.
Shouldn't we do the prosecution team witness rebuttal before we have members of public speak?
I would recommend that, yes, Board Chair.
Okay, so now is the opportunity for the prosecution team.
I'm sorry, Ms. Kincaid, your microphone wasn't on, so I couldn't
hear. I'm sorry. My understanding of the process is that we should also close this matter, and then you take public hearing after the matter has been submitted.
No, that's not the order that was presented in the chair's opening statement.
No. Correct. Okay. So it's the opportunity for the prosecution team to cross-examine respondents' witnesses.
I think we actually already concluded cross-examination, and I believe that Ms. Baer just asked if we have any rebuttal to do, and we do not at this time, so we are prepared to move to closing argument with your leave.
Okay. So I believe that then now I have an opportunity to ask a rebuttal question of the prosecution team. Is that correct?
Yes, it's not a rebuttal question. It's just any questions from the board for either party. So I believe the chair would like to have a question directed to Ms. Van Diepen.
Okay, yes, that's correct. Okay. So, Ms. Van Diepen, on March 25th, 2019, when you visited the site and you had measuring equipment with you in your vehicle, why didn't you take precise measurements that day when you were there?
I don't recall testifying that I did have measuring equipment in my vehicle or GPS, but generally our practice is to rely on dischargers to provide the to characterize the discharge. And so I had not been directed to do a full characterization that day.
So your assumption then was that you would be getting that information from the dischargers, and then they did not supply that information. Is that correct?
Based on my recollection, yes.
Okay, thank you. Now,
any other questions from board members for either party?
If I may, I just wanted to say that you directed that specifically at Ms. Van Diepen. Ms. O'Keefe was also out there. If you wanted to direct the question to her as well, you might have a more holistic answer.
I will accept your suggestion. Ms. O'Keefe, would you like to testify on that question?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Yes, I accompanied Liz Van Diepen during the inspection. I did not have measuring equipment. I used skills that I learned with my education. It's infield mapping. We pace the horizontal length, and we can do mathematical calculations to establish vertical. But to answer your question, I paced it to obtain the area of disturbance.
And your experience, how accurate can you get from pacing over distances of this size?
Very accurate, actually.
Okay, I'll just supply for the room that I used to be an instructor in mapping and surveying at the Yale School of Forestry, and I, in my experience, have found that you can be quite accurate with pacing for instances like this.
I'm going to object for the record if that's evidence being entered in this matter by
Fine.
The chair.
I withdraw that.
Now, Chair, I would invite members of the public that submitted speaker cards to come to the lectern as you call them. And just as a reminder, in the opening statement, each member of the public will be given 3 minutes to make a statement. And we have Alonzo Poach keeping track of that time. Thank you.
But this evidence is different than the evidence that we've heard so far. Can you explain that, please?
These are non-evidentiary statements from the members of the public.
And how should the board weigh them?
They are policy statements from the public. They're not evidence.
Okay, thank you. So I'm just going to call the names in the order I have them here, unless you have a specific order in which you wish to make them.
I would prefer to go first, please.
That just the order in which I...
Marianne Martin.
You want to be first?
Yes, please.
Okay, let me find your card. Okay, Marianne Martin from Park Livestock first.
Good morning, members of the board. Marianne Martin. I represent many of the ranches in the valley and have grave concerns about what I've witnessed here today. First of all, Ms. Van Diepen made a misstatement. What you did that day was not a trespass. A Fourth Amendment violation is nothing compared to, they're totally different things. A trespass, you get a slap on the hand. A Fourth Amendment violation, which is protected by the Constitution, when you're a government agent and you're entering somebody's property without informed consent, results in a Section 1983 civil rights action being brought against not just the Lahontan Board, but Ms. Van Diepen and Ms. O'Keefe personally. I guarantee that that will happen if this fine proceeds. Second of all, I've witnessed an open meeting violation by the chair, Dr. Horn, writing a note, passing it across to two other board members who looked at the note before it reached your council. Your council then got up and brought the note back to Dr. Horn. That note is now part of the evidentiary record, and I would ask that you give it to Park Ranch's Council of Record so that you don't have a statutory OML violation that happened in front of this big room of witnesses. It's one thing for your staff to disregard the Constitution and the law, but we expect more of the people who are entrusted with the authority to actually vote on this decision. As was stated earlier, this is a very serious matter. $3 million of liability is nothing to snicker at. This is serious. We expect you to follow the law. We expect your staff to follow the law, and we certainly expect your staff to follow the Constitution. Out of all of the things that you've heard today, nothing instills confidence in the government. Put yourselves into the position of a rancher. Would you ever allow DFW or any other game warden onto your ranch after what has gone on today? I tell you, absolutely not. If they were worried about fish and wildlife harm, then where is DFW? They didn't even bother to show up in person. Why? Because no fish and wildlife were harmed. We all know that. So I'm going to ask everybody in this room who's actually been to the West Walker River behind me, please raise your hands if you've been to the West Walker River. Okay, next show of hands. How many of you would consider the West Walker River to be non-navigable? Great. These are not people from Sacramento. These are people who live and work in this valley. You sent up a bunch of people without measuring tapes. No GPS, no identification, no business card to say I'm with the Lahontan Board. If you think that the government, because it's an open field, has the right to do whatever they want and enter onto ranch property,
your 3 minutes are up.
Okay. I will just say that is offensive to every American, not just this one.
Thank you for your statement.
Board Chair, if I could just for the record state that the note that was passed is an attorney-client communication and hasn't been waived and it won't be disclosed. Thank you.
That's not true if it passes by the eyes of three different board members in an open meeting.
It was so folded in half fine. And it says counsel on the outside.
That's so. Fine, but it needs to be preserved. Do not destroy that because on appeal, it's being brought into the record.
Okay, Raymond Vieira. Representing Park Ranch. You have 3 minutes.
That does thing going on today. I don't know what this company is. As we can testify, they don't know who I am. As it apparently happened on David's property when people, approached him and trespassed onto his property. It's intentional deceit that I see that this whole party priced to. No core samples are taken. These are scientists, professionals. Walker Lake bottom, the images of humans that calculate discharge, 2 humans, 4 to 8 feet. What's the difference? That's magnanimous. It's outrageous. And the supposed experts of contamination, but yeah, no soap profile is taken, the sand, silt, clay, and organic matter. It's beyond me. The minimal notes, the vague photos, no timestamps on these photos. It's like you guys want to create a narrative to take a hard-earned money of a farmer who works butt off to get what he's got and to try to keep it in this time of it. Your farmers that you want. And thank you.
Thank you for your statement. Nancy Burns from Park Ranch Livestock.
As a member of the public, a diehard conservationist myself, and a rancher's wife, I stand firmly with Park Ranch Livestock and assert the West Walker River is non-navigable. The case put forth today by the prosecution appears to be nothing more than a money-grabbing charade where a group of so-called professionals have grossly failed to provide credible scientific documentation of their alleged findings and calculated the proposed fines on flimsy, unsupported, and quote unquote estimated calculations. What professional in their right mind would stand up and say they don't have the most basic of tools with them when they know they're going out to do an on-site investigation? It would be laughable if the consequences were not so serious. Shame on them. And frankly, it sounds as if Ms. Van Diepen is far too eager to feather her own cap by attempting to secure what she has gleefully declared today to be the single largest fine ever levied and potentially secured by this board. By any estimate, a fine of $3 million is far beyond egregious. And this charade of a prosecution here today has seriously, grievously undermined the credibility of the Hampton Water Board and all members of the prosecution here who dare call themselves professional. It's an embarrassment to our community.
Thank you for your statement. Evan Powers, who doesn't indicate who he's representing. Park Ranch, okay.
So I'm wearing a Park Ranch. I don't directly work for Park Ranch. The argument that government employees can enter private property in reliance on consent given to a different agency simply because one of them was supposedly wearing any piece of Lahontan gear, which was obviously not the case, is not convincing. The West Walker River is not navigable. I've been there myself, and I stand with Park Ranch.
Thank you for your statement. Dominic Lamons, who also does not state who he's representing. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I just wanted to say that first, I think it's really quite embarrassing, actually, how they don't care to say who they are when they go onto the piece of land. It's definitely a violation of the Fourth Amendment. But I also wanted to say, I think that the Lahontan Water Board has been negligent in their job training. They didn't know what they even needed to pack to measure it. They measured by doing a pace count. Did they take a proper 100-meter pace count on that kind of terrain? Because the different terrain changes how you would measure a pace count. I think that maybe the Lahontan Water Board needs to do more on the job training for them. That way they know what kind of tools they need and how to use them. If they did know that, why didn't they bring any? That's it. Thank you.
Thank you for your statement. And Don Harper from Natural Resources Group.
Good afternoon. As a fifth generation California ranching family, board member for the Antelope Valley Mutual Water Company, and also on another water district board as a president, what I really see is something that needs to back up. When I was young, we had very close relationships with representatives of the Forest Service, what was then Fish and Game, and the Army Corps of Engineers. And what I would say to the board today is completely reject this proposed fine and reestablish the connections of those of us that have been attached to the land for over 100 years and work together on a very substantial watershed management project. Thank you.
Thank you for your statement.
Oh, now,
Board Chair, I'd recommend now going into closing statements. The prosecution team would go first, then respondents.
Okay. All right, thank you. So prosecution team, closing statements. Mr. Poach, can you remind them how much time they have?
9 minutes and 10 seconds left.
Good afternoon, board members. My name is Ben Letton. I'm the Assistant Executive Officer for the Lahontan Water Board. I've taken the oath and I'm lead for the prosecution team. And I just wanted to start by pointing out the graph that Mr. Anderson showed with turbidity is a good illustration of how they have brought up some frivolous and non-relevant points as far as his investigative work. We're alleging 2 days of violation on March 18th and 19th, and those turbidity samples were from June. So that's just something to keep in mind as you consider the testimony provided. This is a really egregious violation. We reserve the right to conduct progressive enforcement as part of our enforcement policy, and we consider it very important. If Mr. Anderson, Mr. Park, and others had communicated with us early and often, we always would be willing to consider permitting actions or even after the fact, you know, restoration efforts. However, that was not the case here. Specifically with the investigative order, nothing was provided that could be of utility to us in trying to avoid this right here, this enforcement hearing right now, including settlement with the parties that went pretty much nowhere. Mr. Park and his counsel will contend that they weren't provided opportunity to communicate with after the NOV had been issued. Essentially, the egregiousness of the case made that very difficult to do. And essentially, my interpretation of that is they would like to have seen after the fact permitting. That's not the way that it works. That's not why regulation and law is in place. It's there to protect resources. If every landowner who had river adjacent property conducted work and then after the fact who sought permitting, the very framework of the regulation and the resource protection would not work. With respect to the volume calculations, these were incredibly conservative. We pursued only fill only, not dredge activities, which could have had a twofold increase on the volume that we're considering. We also use extreme conservative estimates in terms of depth of volume. It is, you know, being a professional geologist myself and having done a lot of volume calculations in a natural setting such as this, it's perfectly permissible to do pace calculations, then corroborated and checked by aerial imagery for accuracy, which is length and width and depth, again, very conservative on our part. I will just add that in terms of turbidity and harm, again, we're only alleging 2 days of violation. There was a lot of discussion about porosity and how that influenced this case. But what it doesn't account for is that one cubic yard of sediment has the potential to contaminate thousands of gallons of water. So again, you know, just using the, let's say, roughly 1,800, 1,900 cubic yards of volume calculated, and then converting that directly to gallons is a super conservative estimate compared to the amount of the volume of water, turbid water, that could have flowed down the West Walker on March 18th and 19th. With respect to WOTUS, I think that the prosecution team has demonstrated beyond a reasonable doubt that the West Walker River is navigable. It is a water of the U.S. I find that Mr. Anderson's inability to answer that question perhaps speaks to his, you know, technical capabilities in this case. I'm familiar with the West Walker River. I've been there multiple times. I've fished it. I've watched people boat it. I live in this region, too, and are very familiar with that water body. And I can assure you that there's direct evidence, as well as the basin plan's beneficial uses, that indicate that the West Walker is a navigable water. The penalty amount for this case is appropriate given the seriousness of the violation. Again, we can't have citizens determining on their own whether or not an emergency exists. We did a thorough investigation of the permits that could have been ascertained prior to commencing activities, and there were none. After the fact, permitting is not an appropriate discretionary action in this case. It would set a bad precedence moving forward to modify the recommended amount of the penalty calculation that you're considering today based on that consideration. And finally, I suspect that these violations, for just 2 days of violation, are just the tip of the iceberg in terms of what has been going on in Antelope Valley on properties that are either leased by or owned by Mr. Park. Mr. Park is a rancher, and I understand he cares about, you know, the land and the resources. But this was a travesty in terms of damage to the ecosystem. If the board doesn't consider the full amount of this penalty, you know, it'll continue to be won't be a deterrent factor for others that are out there watching who may be considering similar type of approaches. That's all I have for closing comments.
Board Chair, before respondents' closing statement, I believe some of what Mr. Letton indicated was testimony, and I wanted to give an opportunity for the respondents to conduct a cross if they'd like to.
I think we just would propose to strike any new testimony.
There's two options. You could strike the the portions of the closing statement that were actually testimony in order to be able to do that. I don't want to do that off the top of my head. We'd have to look at a transcript and go line by line and compare it to the record and see what was new testimony as opposed to a summary, which is the purpose of the closing argument. Alternatively, you can let it in. Mr. Letton could have provided all this testimony an hour ago during their case in chief. The only difference is that respondents will be allowed to cross-examine now as opposed to having done it earlier. They can indicate if they want to have Mr. Anderson or one of their other witnesses respond.
To be very conservative, I prefer the first option of looking at a transcript and seeing and then striking whatever is new testimony.
Can I ask for a clarification on that? When you say looking at a transcript, what you are referring to is comparing what he just said to what is in the record, not just in the presentation heard today, but also his deposition.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
In that case,
is that clear to everyone?
Yes. I mean, I think we probably need a discussion about who's going to strike that and what the process is to do that. But I think that's probably a discussion for another time.
Okay.
So in that case, it's time now for the respondent's closing statement.
Thank you. If you can put up prosecution team slide 8, thank you.
Ms. Kincaid, you have 22 minutes and 15 seconds.
Thank you very much. As you see in slide 8 of the prosecution team's presentation today, the prosecution team has the burden to go through and prove that it established each of the three layers you see here, the foundation of a regulatory framework, facts and evidence in this matter supporting all of their alleged allegations. And at the top, it says the roof is the legal level. That's somewhat imprecise. It's actually, these are constitutional requirements that this board is required and the prosecution team is required to comply with. And I'm going to go through this house structure by structure and discuss what we've seen here today. I'm going to start at the top, and there are three legal issues that tend to cave in the roof of the prosecution team's structure. First is the consent to enter Park's property. The prosecution team in this matter needed Park's consent to enter the property. Park's Fourth Amendment rights, of course, as anyone's do, prohibit unlawful search and seizure. The prosecution team could have obtained an investigative warrant. It did not. That means that it was relying on consent. And the rule is where government officials rely on consent to justify the lawfulness of a search, the burden is on them to provide by clear and positive evidence that the consent was freely, voluntarily, and knowledgeably given. Our case citations for every legal rule I'm going to discuss are all in our briefing. What does the evidence show? The evidence is clear that the Lahontan board staff accompanied DFW on a DFW site visit, but it did not have consent itself. The inspection report written by the Lahontan board specifically states that DFW had consent. It does not say the Lahontan board had the same consent. Interestingly, when Ms. Van Diepen was deposed, she confirmed that she did not talk with or contact Park before the site visit. No contact. She understood in her deposition that DFW had consent. She did not testify that she obtained Park's informed consent to enter his property. But in contrast, she deposed under oath, said she could not remember whether she even identified herself to Park as a representative of the board. It's on page 96 of Ms. Van Diepen's deposition testimony. Ms. O'Keefe, also under oath during a deposition, testified she did not obtain consent. She was not aware whether anyone obtained consent.
Warden Elliott, during his deposition, testified he did not know if or how the Lahontan Board obtained any consent to enter Park's property. Park's declaration confirms he did not speak with anyone at the Lahontan Board prior to the DFW site, and no one identified themselves as the Lahontan Board on site. Today, Ms. Van Diepen has changed her story. She now says she did introduce herself and obtain consent. They provided a prosecution team picture of Ms. Van Diepen speaking with David Park. However, it does not appear, from what I can see, that she was wearing any identification that represented the Lahontan Board. Ms. Van Diepen's change in recollection just today is inconsistent with her deposition testimony. It's inconsistent with the inspection report. It's inconsistent with Mr. Park's declaration. And it's inconsistent with everyone else's recollection in this matter. This is not and cannot be clear and positive evidence that the Lahontan Board obtained knowing consent. The second legal issue, it's also a constitutional issue, it's due process and separation of functions. When a state agency conducts an adjudicative proceeding like the one we're doing here today within the Lahontan Board, the Constitution requires a fair tribunal. There's a specific historic case on this issue called Morongo Band of Indians. It's cited in our case, in our brief. And Morongo interprets this to require a separation of functions when you're doing an internal hearing as we are today. If you are on the advisory team advising the board, you cannot have any contact with the prosecution team. And specifically, Morongo has two very clear rules. One, there is an absolute prohibition on serving on both the advisory and the prosecution team in the same manner. It cannot be done. It's an automatic Morongo violation. It's a due process violation. It's a constitutional violation. Second, there must be proof of separation of offices, separation of resources, such as copy machines, restrooms, and physical offices. Those are requirements in Morongo. What does the evidence show in this case? The evidence shows that Mr. Letton served on both teams. The evidence in this matter shows that Mr. Letton was on the advisory team roster for more than 2 years in this matter, from May 2019 until July 2021. In addition, there are several emails from Ms. Koyomagian, I'm sorry about her name, to Mr. Letton attaching the advisory team roster that he was on and scheduling meetings to discuss these items with him. In his deposition, Mr. Letton testified and confirmed he had regular updates on pending enforcement with Patty once a quarter, and they discussed different cases, page 75 of his deposition. In total, Mr. Letton was listed as an advisory team member for the Park Livestock matter on 11 different rosters over more than a two-year period. In addition to this, Mr. Letton's deposition makes clear there was no physical separation of the teams in this matter. He shares an office wall with advisory team members. There was no evidence of separation of office space, printers, bathrooms, or any other required Morongo separation issues. In fact, in May of this year, the morning after the presiding officer conducted a pre-hearing conference at which separation of functions issues was discussed, an unauthorized ex parte communication occurred between the advisory team members and prosecution team, which had to be disclosed. These are very clear Morongo violations. Again, the roof of the house, it is not supported. Finally, the final legal issue is the due process and burden flipping. And this is perhaps the most serious of the constitutional violations. The prosecution team has violated due process rules, which require the prosecution team establish its case in chief first, before the defendant has to establish its case and engage in discovery. Evidence Code 500 requires the prosecution team must demonstrate each allegation in its case in chief by a preponderance of the evidence. Critical here is that these facts cannot come in as rebuttal evidence. State Water Resources Control Board case, Water Right Hearing Matter 2016-0015, in the matter of the ACL on the Byron Bethany Irrigation District, specifically says, once you have failed to put your case in chief,
You cannot correct that failure through rebuttal. So what do all of these codes and cases prohibit? They prohibit sandbagging. And there's a reason for that. It's not just a technicality. The reason is they create actual prejudice. The prosecution team must provide its evidence first in its case in chief, because the next step in this case is discovery. You depose witnesses, you get to ask them questions about their case in chief, you test the veracity of the information they have put forward. And so it's a place where witnesses are deposed, facts are checked. If a prosecutor waits until rebuttal, the defendant loses this opportunity. You cannot ask them about rebuttal evidence. Discovery has closed. You don't get to test the facts that they put forward in rebuttal. It has closed. This is why the constitutional protection is in place. What does the evidence show in this matter? The final hearing procedures were issued in November 2023. It required that on December 1, 2023, the prosecution team was required to provide all evidence for its case in chief, all legal and all technical arguments. When December 1st came, the prosecution team submitted 28 exhibits, which included only one very short two-page declaration regarding staff hours. What didn't it submit? It submitted no legal argument at all, zero. It submitted no technical argument at all, zero. It submitted no evidence at all that it had consent to conduct a site investigation. It had no evidence that the West Walker River is a WOTUS. It had no evidence that existing river materials moved by respondents were pollutants. Instead, the prosecution team waited. They waited until Park submitted its evidence and its brief and technical arguments. Then, after discovery had closed, after the time to test these evidentiary components was over, the prosecution team included several submitted in rebuttal, several declarations, 60 additional pieces of evidence. Okay, so we had 28 on its case in chief, 60 in rebuttal. And for the first time, they put forward their case in chief by submitting argument for the very first time. After David Park had to submit his information, argument, it was all on rebuttal. This is a constitutional due process violation. By submitting these items after discovery closed, it prevented Park from asking witnesses about the new information and their arguments provided by the prosecution team. The prosecution team may be comfortable trampling due process rights, but you are the board, you have a choice. You do not have to do the same. You should refuse to ratify what has happened in this case. It is unconstitutional, and we request that you reject any rebuttal evidence that's offered in this matter. I'll move on to the second layer of the house, and that's the facts in this matter. And toxicity, harm, and volume calculation are the three items that the prosecution team needed to provide evidence, factual documentation on, and they failed. On toxicity, enforcement policy requires the prosecution team evaluate toxicity and provide a score from 0 to 4. The prosecution team proposes a score of 2, which in its presentation, it failed to tell you that score of 2 requires, by the preponderance of the evidence, that it provide chemical and physical characteristics of the discharge materials and prove that there is some level of toxicity. There is no evidence of toxicity in this case. No samples taken, no materials tested, no observation of the physical or chemical characteristics in the record. Today, there was a single picture in the prosecution team presentation of muddy water on a side channel. Muddy water on a side channel is not evidence of toxicity. It is certainly not evidence of toxicity in the channel itself, which is what the prosecution team is required to prove. It is a pillar of the house they did not build and cannot support. I'll move on to harm. Enforcement policy requires the prosecution team evaluate harm and score from 0 to 5. Prosecution team in this matter proposes a score of 5, the absolute most harm. It requires the prosecution team to provide a preponderance of the evidence first that harm was either observed
or if not observed, that potential significant impacts to beneficial uses, which the code describes as more than 5 days of significant impacts on beneficial uses. So let's go through what the evidence shows. There's no observation of harm on the initial visit. We deposed Warden Elliott. He testifies he saw no fish, no wildlife, no riparian habitat, no harm at all. Observation of harm 5 days later during the DFW site visit. Each deposed witness said they saw no fish, they saw no harm to wildlife, they saw no harm to any other beneficial use, recreation, municipal. There are no pictures of fish and wildlife or habitat or any other beneficial use in this matter. There are no videos of fish and wildlife. There are no notes from the inspection reports noting any beneficial use impacts. So that's the observed. How about potential impacts? What did the prosecution team fail to provide? No affidavit of witnesses saying they've seen fish and wildlife. No expert testimony saying that fish and wildlife normally exist in the area. No documentation designating the area as a wildlife zone. No scientific papers explaining what fish and wildlife could exist. None of this is in the record. No natural resource damage assessment, which is the standard to evaluate impacts of unlawful discharges. It wasn't done here. And in fact, when you turn to the deposition testimony, Mr. Letton testifies, he understands the potential impacts in this case to be limited to 2 days of turbidity. He actually testifies that for the purposes of this ACL, potential impacts are limited to 2 days of turbidity. That does not meet the standard. And in fact, Ms. Van Diepen's deposition testimony says by the time she arrives, when asked about turbidity, the water, and I quote, is running clear. So there is no evidence in this matter of turbidity. There's no evidence in this matter of harm to beneficial uses. Move on to the volume calculation. Again, the volume calculation must be evidence of the evidence. And what does that mean? It means facts upon which a responsible person would rely. First, I want to talk really quickly about measurement devices. You've heard that there were no measurement devices taken. However, this contradicts two very specific pieces of evidence in this matter. First, page 16 of Ms. O'Keefe's deposition, she specifically says that she has a GPS recorder coordinate at the site. Page 16, Ms. O'Keefe confirms she has a GPS device. Rebuttal exhibit 2, there is a picture. It's labeled DSC01496. It is a picture of Ms. Van Diepen. She is holding a tape measure. So they did have the ability to measure in this case. They had the devices out there. I can't explain why they didn't do it. But in this case, you have no measurements. And in fact, the Myers analysis on volume calculation says this. In his deposition, he says, I wasn't given the tools to do the method I wanted to do, to come up with a correct estimate. So what does the evidence show? Well, we just saw two pieces of that, but also keep in mind that the Myers analysis is not the type of information upon which a responsible person would rely. Why? He is not qualified. He is not an engineer or was not an engineer at the time that this was done. He never went to the site, not once. He relied on pictures he did not take. He relied on landmarks he could not see, but assume existed. He engaged in a discipline called photogrammetry he had never heard of. He conceded he was not provided the tools and information he needed to provide a reliable estimate. This is all in his deposition, and it's in our brief. He could not explain how he drew the polygons, which served as the basis of his calculations. His calculations included overlap and double-counted material. He failed to account for basic engineering tenets, such as compaction and porosity. And in the end, the only qualified engineer testifying in this matter told you that this is not the type of calculation a responsible person could rely on. So again, the pillar of a volume calculation is not built. The house is not built correctly. It has no pillars holding up the roof, and the roof has caved in. Finally, I'll move on to my last point, the foundation and the regulatory framework.
The regulatory framework in this case is Clean Water Act Section 301, and it prohibits the discharge of pollutants into waters of the United States. This requires the prosecution team to prove three things. One, that there was a discharge, not a movement of material, but a discharge. Two, that discharge had to be of a pollutant. And three, that it has to be into a water of the United States. So what does the evidence show? A discharge of a pollutant is defined by 33 U.S.C. Section 1362, subsection 12. And a discharge is defined as an addition of any pollutant to a navigable water from any point source. That's the definition. There are a series of cases on the section that specifically evaluate this that says the movement of existing materials do not amount to an addition of materials. Specifically, there's a case that says if you dip a soup ladle into the pot, bring up soup, do not change the characterization of that soup and dump it back in, it is not a discharge. So the movement of existing materials in this matter cannot be a discharge unless they are changed so transformatively that the material itself changes. And that didn't happen here. We don't have evidence in the record that there is an actual discharge in this matter. Second, there has to be evidence that there's a pollutant. We already talked about this. There is no evidence of toxicity. No materials were taken and no evidence of pollutants. And finally, the prosecution team provides no evidence that the West Walker River is a water of the United States. There is no evidence that it has been designated as a WOTUS by the Army Corps of Engineers, which is the agency that is required to do it. There is no evidence that it is navigable. We did not see any evidence that it's navigable here today. And in fact, the only evidence in this case is a federal case stating the West Walker River is non-navigable. Without any overriding court decision or determination, this is binding. So we see that even the foundational layer has not been set correctly. There is no discharge. There's no addition of materials. There is no evidence that there was a pollutant involved. And there is no evidence of a WOTUS, a water of the United States. With that, we will end our closing argument today. We do request the board review PERC's briefing in this matter very carefully. There is a lot of technical information in this, as you've seen today. All of the issues I just summarized very, very quickly, given the short time, are fully supported with citation and argument in our opening brief. We request that after you review that brief and evaluate the house that the prosecution team was supposed to build, did it lay a foundation? No. Did it provide facts, information, evidence to support the structure of that house? It did not. Did it comply with this? Did it have a roof on the house? I mean, it was referred to as the legal level. These are constitutional requirements that are very serious, and they did not meet them. We ask that the Lahontan Board decline to issue the ACL in this matter. Thank you.
Thank you. If there is nothing else, I will close the record of this hearing. Let me read ahead here. Okay.
Board Chair, let me ask Katrina if lunch is here. That might help you arrange the next steps.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So what do you recommend?
The board could either go on a lunch break and then enter into closed session or have a working lunch during closed session.
Okay. What does the board prefer?
Working lunch?
Working lunch. Okay. Well, we will go into closed session, during which we will have a working lunch. Okay. So pursuant to Government Code Section 111.26, subdivision C3, the board will go into closed session to deliberate on this matter. Closed session will take place at the Lahontan Regional Board South Lake Tahoe office located at 2501 Lake Tahoe Boulevard, South Lake Tahoe, California. We will reconvene in this hearing room when we have completed our deliberations. The board may also have additional questions for the parties and may choose to reopen the hearing. Parties and the public are welcome to stay in this hearing room or the Zoom platform while the board is in closed session. Let's see. I think maybe the best way to go is for each party to provide the advisory team with their cell phone contact information. So the advisory team will contact you by text when the board is about to reconvene in open session.
So parties, you don't need to do that if you don't want to. You can welcome to stay in this hearing room, but we just wanted to provide an opportunity for you all to get lunch and a break without worrying to come back into the hearing room. So if you like, you could give us your cell phone numbers and we'll contact you.
And if the parties and their witnesses do decide to leave the hearing room or the Zoom platform, we ask that they be near enough to return promptly if we reconvene in open session.
Thank you. We'll provide our contact. We appreciate the consideration.
Do you want to give them a time certain when you know we won't be coming back so they can go to lunch without worrying about having to come back? An hour and a half?
I'd say
2 hours.
2 hours? Okay. So it's 1 o'clock now. Split the difference. 2:30? Is that right? That's... hour and 45 minutes. 2:30, time certain.
So just to clarify, 2:30 would be the earliest that the board is coming back into open session. So we won't come before then. So
thank you. And if I do have one request, that if the matter is taken under submission, and I think this was Ms. Hogan's point, and you won't return today or need more time, the soonest that you can tell us that would be much appreciated. Thank you.
Understood.
Thank you.
TV team. Okay, we are back in, the board is now back in open session. Our council has some questions to ask.
Board Chair, can you reopen the hearing for this portion of the...
Didn't I just do that? I am reopening the hearing.
Thank you. David Park, can you please come to the stand? We have a question for you. So there's been some discussion today regarding whether or not consent was granted, and there's some lack of clarity if that was before, during, or after the March 25th inspection. So would you like to ask you a clarifying question? David Park, is it your testimony that you never gave consent to the Water Board staff to access your leased property at any time?
No, I don't believe I gave any Water Board employee access to our property at any time.
I have no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Park.
Okay, so I will now close the hearing.
Thank you.
Consideration of this item will be continued to a future board meeting. Prior to that future board meeting, the advisory team will circulate a proposed order. The board will vote on the order at a future board meeting. The board is not required to reopen the hearing or allow written or oral comments on the proposed order, but may choose to do so. Does anyone have any questions before we adjourn for the day?
I have one question regarding the striking of closing testimony. Will that be stricken from the transcript prior to the proposed order? And will we get to see how that testimony was struck? Or is that something that you're just going to park and then do a proposed order?
Striking of closing hearing?
The closing by Mr. Letton included a motion to strike that you sustained.
And we said that later we would look at the transcript and strike the portions of the testimony that were not substantiated and new. There were several facts that Mr. Letton testified to in his closing and did not testify to as a called witness here today. We left that as an open issue. I'm wondering how you plan to resolve it.
I believe my understanding is that that will be resolved in the future order, right?
That'll be addressed in the proposed order. And just to be clear, the testimony that may be stricken isn't limited. We will strike testimony as, let me start over. We'll strike any portion of the closing statement that was new testimony that didn't appear previously in the record or in today's testimony, not just in the hearing today.
Thank you for the clarification.
Any other questions before we adjourn for the day? Hearing none, thank you. This concludes day one of the regular board meeting of the Lahontan Water Board.
Thank you for the consideration.
We will resume tomorrow at 9 a.m.